I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum present. Today, during our regular 3 o'clock meeting, we'll be taking up 5 bills. We'll recess at 4:45 and come back at 6 to take up the remaining 7 bills. The agenda and timeline for the hearing have been posted for the public and is included in your committee materials. Before we get to our agenda, we have just the safety notice. Everyone here today must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There will be no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need further accommodation, please communicate with the sergeant's staff. Signs are not permitted in the hearing room or at the testifier's table. Please leave them outside. Clapping or other disruptions are not allowed. All the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit for testimony. Please adhere to these time limits or we may have to cut you off, so we can hear from as many people as possible. Thank you to our sergeant's office staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee hearing room. And thank you to everybody who submitted letters and written testimony. They are posted online and there are some limited copies in the front, and of course they're in the member packets. The first order of business is to approve the last meeting's minutes. Representative Johnson, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 18th, 2026?
So moved.
Representative Johnson moves approval of the minutes for March 18th, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes for March 18th, 2026 are approved. The first bill, we are going to make one adjustment to the agenda, and we're going to begin with House File 3407. That is Chair Pinto's bill. Chair Pinto, would you like to move to re-refer House File 3407 to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
That's my motion, Madam Chair.
All right, and I don't see any amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that there is an amendment, but not an author's amendment, so we'll get to that.
Yes, we'll get to that later.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks. Members, prior to quite recently, Minnesota law required that firearms in the state be identified via serial number. There were certain exceptions to that, but that was a general rule. The Minnesota Supreme Court issued an opinion, as I say, relatively recently, interpreting the state law to significantly limit that prior requirement. House File 3407 simply reverts state law back to that prior condition, but with the addition and the improvement of providing a method to serialize those firearms that did not previously have serial numbers. We're going to talk about the importance of firearms having serial numbers by way of our testifiers largely, but I wanted, as I say, simply note that what the bill does is revert to the state prior to August when the Supreme Court issued that case of Vagel, but with also allowing firearms to be serialized. And I think what I'll do at this point, Madam Chair, is move to testifiers to talk about why it's so important that firearms be serialized.
All right, thank you. Our first testifier is Attorney General Keith Ellison. There you are. And we've also got Eric Maloney, Assistant Attorney General. Yeah, and then it looks like Chief O'Hare, Minneapolis Police Chief O'Hare, is here as well. Welcome, everybody, to the committee. And Attorney General Ellison, I believe you're first. If you would go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Certainly. My name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. And I want to thank you, Chair Moeller, Chair Novotny, and Representative Pinto, and all members for inviting me to be here with you today. Let me say from the very beginning, I am so honored that Chief O'Hara from Minneapolis Police Department is here, because perhaps more than anybody in our state, he knows the implications of unserialized guns and the implications for them. I hope you hear from him in a moment. But allow me to make a few things clear. First of all, this bill is absolutely necessary at this time. Although Minnesota Statute 609.677 already bans removing or altering serial numbers on firearms, a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision found that Minnesota statute only requires firearms to have serial numbers if the guns are required to be serialized under federal law. By tying Minnesota's current statute to constantly changing federal regulatory standards that currently do not outright prohibit all ghost guns, this ruling has created a significant and dangerous loophole in state law that I respectfully submit requires your urgent attention to close. As you know, ghost guns are firearms that can be printed 3D printed or assembled at home in kits sold online. Ghost guns present a clear and present danger to Minnesotans and our public safety for at least three reasons. First, ghost guns make criminal investigations more difficult. Ghost guns lack serial numbers that traditional firearms have, rendering these guns untraceable, which can significantly undermine law enforcement investigations. Second, ghost guns bypass background checks. It can take just an hour to print a hour or two to print a 3D ghost gun or assemble one from a kit purchased online. When that happens, a background check process is bypassed entirely, allowing dangerous individuals who may be legally prohibited from having firearms, who cannot pass a background check, to acquire a gun. Third, ghost guns remove a major deterrent for gun traffickers. Serial numbers on traditional firearms deter individuals from gun trafficking, that is, illegally selling firearms to other people who are legally prohibited from owning a gun. If firearms with serial numbers that are recovered at a crime scene can be traced back to someone who claims to no longer own them, law enforcement may begin investigating that individual for gun trafficking. The lack of a serial number on a ghost gun makes it far harder to identify who sold or trafficked the firearm. Let me just give you a real-life example that my office dealt with not too long ago. It involves a young woman by the name of Markeisha Wiley. Markeisha Wiley was killed at the Truck Park restaurant in St. Paul, walking distance from where we are right now. Now, Markeisha, who was killed in October 2021, happened to be out with friends socializing, Madam Chair, and she happened to be there when these two individuals started shooting at each other, and they hit 14 people and killed her. It is because the gun found on the scene could be linked to Jerome Horton, who purchased the gun that was used at the Truck Park shooting. And because he purchased 32 other firearms from a local retailer, that the gun could be traced back to where the gun started from. And because of that, law enforcement was able to prosecute Jerome Horton, put him in prison where he belonged, and hold him accountable for the gun trafficking that helped generate the mayhem that happened at that truck park and cost the life of Markeisha Wiley. The untraceability of that, if that gun was untraceable, no one would ever know. And yet, because it was traceable, we're able to get to the bottom of where that gun came from and what and who the trafficker was. The availability or untraceability of ghost guns is a growing problem in Minnesota. In the last 5 years, from 2017 to 2021, 187 ghost guns were recovered at crime scenes. So from 2017 to 2021, about 187 guns. In the two subsequent years, 2022 and 2023, 631 ghost guns were recovered at crime scenes, a 600% increase. Criminals know that if you want to commit a crime with a gun, get a ghost gun. So we're asking you to put a stop to it. I'll yield back for other witnesses.
Thank you, and it looks like Chief O'Hara, you're sitting there, so I assume you're next. Please introduce yourself. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, my name is Brian O'Hara, and I'm the police chief in Minneapolis. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for having me here today. As you know, police officers and first responders deal with the consequences of community violence and shootings every day. We're the people who have to go and provide first aid and try and save lives, and then afterwards to try and help bring some sense of justice to the people who are victimized in our state. Law enforcement officers carry the weight of what they witness, the impact that it has on people in the community, family members and victims, and really lives that are shattered in an instant. And it's a weight that weighs on us every single day and gets progressively worse over the course of a year of a career. Personally manufactured firearms, as the Attorney General has said, commonly referred to as ghost guns, are difficult to track and they present a continuing growing threat and challenge to law enforcement across the country. It's a problem that appeared a few years ago on the west coast of this country and then began to proliferate in the Northeast and has come to Minnesota in the last few years. In 2019, the Minneapolis Police Crime Lab processed only 3 ghost guns that were recovered at crime scenes. By 2022, that increased exponentially to 111 ghost guns being recovered at crime scenes. While that has declined in recent years, already this year, year to date, we've recovered 14 ghost guns involved in crimes, including one that is involved in one of the murders that has happened this year in the city. Dozens of firearms also have produced NIBIN hits in Minneapolis, which is the National Integrated Ballistics Information Network. It's essentially the tracing of the firearms that are used at crime scenes. And while approximately nationwide from 2016 to 2021, there were approximately 45,000 suspected ghost guns recovered from potential crime scenes, including 642 homicides or attempted homicides. And of those recovered in Minneapolis, where we've had NIBIN hits, they've been linked to shell casings that are typically recovered at scenes of gunfire. In 2022 alone, there were 32 ghost guns that were connected to shooting hits in the city, a trend that has continued with 22 NIBIN hits in 2025. Worse yet, in recent years, multiple ghost guns processed in Minneapolis have been recovered from homicide cases, including 6 homicide cases in 2024 and 1 already this year. Ghost guns are dangerous in part because they can be assembled and transferred outside of regulated systems. They lack serial numbers, as other firearms do, which significantly impacts our investigative efforts. In addition, they can be assembled by individuals who, as the AG mentioned, are legally prohibited from possessing firearms, which is unacceptable for law enforcement. And that's who we're worried about. We're worried about the convicted felons, juveniles, and other people who are unlawfully able to possess firearms that get a hold of these things and then wind up using them in crimes to harm people in our state. So we're supportive of requiring serial numbers, as other firearms lawfully possessed are required to have, and regulating the components used to make ghost guns. And we believe this will help increase and strengthen our ability to investigate gun crimes when they occur, and also to help provide a better sense of justice for the victims. So I thank you for having me and for your time to consider this important bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. And I understand you have someone else from the AG's office here to answer questions if needed. Is that correct? Just so the agendas.
That is correct, Madam
Members
Chair.
Can note that on their agenda. Then we also have public testimony. We have Mariana Mitchum has signed up virtually. So we will switch to virtual here.
And hi, thank you.
Yes, go right ahead. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Mariana Mitchum, and I'm currently the Senior Industry Advisor for Everytown for Gun Safety. But prior to joining Everytown, I was an industry operations investigator for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. I worked for ATF for over 20 years, and when I retired last May, I was part of the executive staff, serving as the Associate Assistant Director of Field Operations. In that position, I was responsible for overseeing and regulating the firearms industry. This includes the more than 1,500 federal firearm licensees, commonly referred to as licensed gun stores, operating here in Minnesota. During my 20-year career, I developed and instituted ATF's Crime Gun Intelligence Analytics System, which primarily utilizes trace data to identify violent offenders and trigger pullers, the traffickers that armed them, and the gun stores that supplied them. This crime gun trace information provides critical intelligence and viable investigative leads for local, state, and federal law enforcement as they investigate violent crimes. It's important to understand how crime gun tracing works, especially to better understand how it can break down. When a firearm is recovered in a crime, law enforcement submits the description of the firearm, which includes the serial number, to ATF. ATF then tracks down the history of the firearm by contacting the manufacturer, distributor, and ultimately the last known licensed gun store that sold the firearm. ATF then provides back to the requesting law enforcement agency where the firearm was purchased, when it was purchased, and who purchased it, including their name, date of birth, driver's license information, and address. When a firearm lacks a serial number, this trace is impossible to complete. Law enforcement will be unable to identify the last known purchaser, and they will have no lead to pursue in their effort to identify and apprehend suspects and prevent future acts of violence. The intelligence provided by crime gun tracing is even more critical during an active shooter situation. Who bought the gun? Are there additional bad actors that could be joining the active shooter? All of that information is helpful through the crime gun trace. There are two main reasons ghost guns are attractive to criminals who can't legally purchase guns, and especially to individuals planning to commit gun crimes. They are untraceable, and they circumvent the background check process. This is why their use in crimes has grown exponentially over the years. In Minnesota alone, as the AG stated, ghost gun recoveries have increased 237% from 187 recovered between 2017 and 2021 to 631 recovered between 2022 and 2023. During that time, 94 of those were machine gun conversion devices, which can be slipped in easily into a firearm and made to fire fully auto. I am testifying today to ask you to support law enforcement in their efforts to solve gun crimes, combat gun trafficking, and keep our communities safe by advancing this bill to prohibit unserialized ghost guns so that our officers have the information they need to hold the criminal actors accountable. I encourage members of the committee to vote yes on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, and we have three testifiers who have signed up in opposition. And if you all want to make your way to the table now, we've got Mariah Day, Anna Leaney, and Brian Gosch. Welcome back to the committee. If you want to introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Mariah Day, I represent the National Shooting Sports Foundation. We're the trade association for the firearms, ammunition, hunting, and recreational shooting sports industry. I won't belabor the points that I already made in my written testimony, which I believe you have before you, but I do want to take just a moment to emphasize a couple facts here for your consideration. Federal law treats privately manufactured firearms for personal use very different than firearms that have been illegally altered to deface or eliminate an existing serial number. We're concerned that conflating the various issues addressed by this bill and redefining distinct types under one rather ambiguous umbrella term of ghost guns will only muddy the waters. A firearm may lack a serial number for a number of reasons. Some are blatantly illegal under current federal law, and some are perfectly legitimate, such as being manufactured before 1968. For years, every firearm manufacturer in America has applied serial numbers to their products prior to sale. That unfortunately still doesn't stop criminals from illegally defacing stolen firearms by removing their serial numbers to make it more difficult for the legal system to hold them accountable for their crimes. I'd like to encourage the committee to avoid obscuring the fact that violent criminals are far more likely to use firearms that were stolen and obtained on the black market with obliterated serial numbers than they are to use firearms requiring NFA registration, such as the undetectable firearms that are mentioned in the bill. Many law-abiding firearm owners in Minnesota regularly swap out stocks, sights, scopes, and optics, trigger assemblies, barrels, upper receivers, and other components of their firearms for different kinds of shooting activities. Vague restrictions on the assembly of firearms could inadvertently put many of these gun owners in violation of the law, or at least in a legal gray area. It's always been a serious crime for a prohibited possessor to own a firearm of any kind, and this includes self-made firearms. I would encourage you to oppose HF 3407. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Leaney, welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Leaney, Director of Government Relations and Advocacy for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. House File 3407 expands criminal law to regulate the activities of ordinary gun owners. This bill is not about misuse, but it is about possession. House File 3407 would make it a felony to possess an unserialized firearm, even if it was lawfully manufactured and possessed under current law. Owners would be forced to either serialize the firearm through a federally licensed dealer, surrender it to law enforcement, or render it permanently inoperable. For generations, Americans have lawfully built firearms for personal use. federal law has long allowed individuals to manufacture firearms for themselves as long as the individual is not selling the firearm. House File 3407 would make many of these privately manufactured firearms illegal to possess in Minnesota if they do not have a government-approved serial number. This bill forces current owners to serialize, surrender, destroy, or move lawfully owned property within strict deadlines. It assumes that federally licensed dealers will provide serialization services, that costs will be reasonable, and that access will exist across the state. None of that is guaranteed. By effectively prohibiting private firearm manufacturing, unless performed by a federally licensed manufacturer, this bill criminalizes conduct that has historically been lawful. House File 3407 also raises serious First Amendment concerns by criminalizing the distribution of digital files used to design or manufacture firearms using 3D printing or CNC technology. Courts have repeatedly held that computer code is protected speech under the First Amendment. Minnesota already has extensive criminal laws addressing violent offenses, illegal firearm possession by prohibited persons, and misuse of firearms. Expanding criminal liability for law-abiding citizens engaged in historically lawful conduct does not better serve public safety. For these reasons, I urge you to vote no on House File 3407.
Thank you. And I see that you're there too, Mr. Gosch. Welcome back to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Pennell, good to see you again. My name is Brian Gosch. I'm a lawyer, registered lobbyist with the National Rifle Association, here opposing this bill today. I would agree with the previous remark you just heard from the previous two speakers and add again and emphasize that the ghost gun category really is conflating three distinct issues. One is the undetectable firearm, two is the personally made firearm, and three is the 3D printer as a piece of equipment to manufacture many different things, but including firearms. To the first one, the undetectable firearm, that was already made illegal in 1988 under the Federal Undetectable Firearms Act. There's been several reiterations since then, and the most recent version also includes what they call a security exemplar of 3.7 ounces of stainless steel. It has to be into the firearm so that it can be detected through metal detectors, particularly at airport security. Also, major components like the slide, the receiver, also have to look like that and be detectable to those security screenings. So that's the undetectable portion of, they're trying to lump that all into one category. The other one's a personally made firearm, and I can belabor that, because you heard that for centuries we've allowed people to make their own firearms and not have to adhere to the strict regulation and put a serial number on. But if they go to transfer it, then they do have to put a serial number on it. If they're trying to manufacture these and then sell them, like you heard, you have to put a serial number on it. The third one is the 3D printer. The 3D printer is used for aerospace components, automotive components, dental and medical implants like hips and knees and dental devices. How an object is manufactured doesn't change the rules that apply to it. So if you're a prohibited person, you still can't possess a firearm. If you do, you risk 15 years in prison. If you manufacture through 3D technology an undetectable firearm, for one, that firearm's probably not going to be functional, but two, that's a crime. You go to prison for up to 5 years. A couple more things I'll finish with in the bill that I think it's worth noting. If you look at line 2.3 of the bill, it purports to exempt firearms manufactured prior to 1968. But that's under the category of ghost guns. But then if you look at subdivision 5, so lines 2.25 through 2.28, it ceases to use the term ghost gun and then uses firearm. And it says every firearm has to have a serial number within 180 days. And if you go down to the exceptions for that, it is not included in the exceptions are guns manufactured prior to 1968. And so there was testimony on the Senate side that this exempts all firearms prior to 1968. I think there's a conflict in that within that section I just referenced. And then finally, if you look at the language found at 4.4 through 4.9 and how they define assembly of a firearm, and you heard testimony earlier about this too, but I want to emphasize this because If you're a private owner and you're regularly adjusting the uppers and lowers for the type of shooting you're doing, you might be shooting deer, you might be shooting varmints, you might be target shooting. This law seems to limit you to be able to change those uppers and lowers three times a year. I don't think that's the purpose of it, but I think that's the effect of it. So with that, I'll stand by for questions, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that concludes the testifiers who have signed up today. So we will move first to the DE1 amendment. Who's going to be offering? Representative Bliss, please explain your DE.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We feel that it's important to hold these criminals that are using these guns accountable. And instead of banning the tool, we'd want to increase the penalty on the persons. So that's my DE.
All right. Representative Pinto to the DE1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bliss. Well, first, what your DE1 would do is that it would gut the bill in the sense that the benefits that the Attorney General referenced of serialization in terms of investigation of crimes by ensuring that transfer guns pass through a background check, the deterrent, et cetera, that would all be removed in what you're doing, because this would simply increase penalties for crimes that are committed when the firearm does not have a serial number. I guess one question I'd ask you is why is it better in your view if someone commits one of these crimes if that gun has a serial number? Because essentially you'd be calling for a lesser sentence in that case. Do you prefer it when somebody does that? I would urge members to vote no and to instead vote to return our law to the way that it was before last August, that guns were required to have serial numbers. And I would urge them to vote against the DE1. And of course, Representative Bliss might want to respond to what I asked, Madam Chair.
Sure. Representative Bliss.
This bill is just addressing the serialized portion that you're trying to address, and we feel that I feel that it doesn't stop the crime by adjusting the tool. You get the person off the street, which is one of the problems that we're having with guns right now. Is we're seeing multiple people out in the streets with multiple offenses, creating this crime. If you start locking the people up, maybe the crime will go down.
All right, further discussion to the DE1? I guess I have a question. I assume this would have a cost. Representative Bliss, do you?
I don't have a fiscal note on it, and I would like a roll call, please.
Okay, surely. Roll call has been requested. Co-Chair Nabotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'd like to point out that in the entirety of the bill, which would make thousands of people in possession of firearms that would be deemed illegal in this, there is zero financial impact. So I would find it hard to believe that we'd have a fiscal impact that would be greatly increased based on the fact that there's no fiscal note for the entire bill. I recommend a no vote.
Chair,
the amendment, I recommend against both.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Chair Navani, I'll just note that, you know, you have the fiscal note in front of you. If you think that there's something that's an incorrect assumption, certainly point that out. But as you correctly note, the analysis has been done by a variety of agencies and found that, in fact, there would not be a cost to the underlying bill. I think we can assume that there would be a cost to the DE1. That would be another reason to vote against it, besides, of course, that we would lose the benefits of serialization. So I'd urge members to vote no on the DE1.
Right. Thank you. And I'll just note that the DE does have, it's the increased penalties that we believe would create a fiscal note here.
Indeed.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
No.
Chair Mueller, no. Chair Novotny.
Aye.
Chair Novotny, aye. Vice Chair Feist. Vice Chair Witte.
Yes.
Vice Chair Witte, aye. Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Berg, no. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Representative Bliss, yes. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Curran, no. Representative Duran.
Yes.
Representative Duran, yes. Representative Engen. Representative Greenman.
No.
Representative Greenman, no. Representative Harder.
Yes.
Representative Harder, yes. Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Hollins, no. Representative Hudson. Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Johnson, no. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto, no. Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Ream, no. Representative Rapinski?
Yes.
Representative Rapinski, yes. Representative Schwartz?
Yes.
Representative Schwartz, yes. Representative Steer?
Yes.
Representative Steer, yes. Representative Tabke?
No.
Representative Tabke, no. 9 noes, 8 yeas.
There being 8 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. All right, next we'll move on to discussion of the bill. Member discussion. Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I maybe have a question for our AG, Ms. Jobson.
Go ahead and ask your question while they're coming to the table, please.
Ask your question.
Thank you. I heard some staggering numbers, 600 plus weapons. Of those unsterilized numbers, unsterilized weapons, what was the percentage of weapons that had a serial number physically removed on it compared to no serial number at all?
Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, those are ones without a serial number. They would have a different category if they were defaced or removed serial numbers. We put them in that, we count them in a different area.
Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. Can you give me the numbers on which they have that were removed?
Yeah.
Attorney General
Ellison. None. These are the numbers of unserialized weapons found. There's somebody out there knows how many numbers of guns where the serial number was removed. Maybe my colleague has the information.
Right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and answer that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric Maloney, Assistant Attorney General. Representative Rapinski, that is, I believe what the Attorney General has said is correct, that it is a different category. This is based on ATF data. I don't have those numbers in front of me right now on obliterated serial numbers. I think that's something we could dig up, but don't have it at hand at the moment.
Okay. Any further questions? No?
Thank you.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, and thank you, Chair Pinto, for bringing this bill. I know that in the context of gun violence and gun violence in Minnesota specifically, we've heard some stats already on ghost guns that we're talking about today. And I think in the general context of gun violence prevention, I think it's important that we are taking some steps forward in that folks who are responsible gun owners think about taking some additional steps in that responsibility. And I say that as a gun owner who, as we talk about a variety of bills, would impact me as well. And I may have to go through certain other processes to ensure that the guns that I currently own would be lawful under the new laws that we enact. For me, that's something that I weigh, and I feel that it's worth it. I feel that the public health benefit alone of leaning into some more responsible actions to me is something that I'm not only comfortable with, but I feel that we are accountable for that, and we are accountable for making some really difficult decisions. And I think sometimes coming to the conclusion that owning up to a little more responsibility can be challenging for folks. And I certainly see that in this discussion as well. I see that in the opposition letters. And I just want to address a couple of those points that, it's true that if we make a new law that says a current behavior as of this date is now a crime, yes, after that date, engaging in that behavior would be a crime. So to say that criminalizing law-abiding Minnesotans, it's misrepresenting, I think, what the goal is here. And the goal is that we would all remain law-abiding, even with some changes here that don't necessarily, I understand folks might feel punished as gun owners, but this is really, again, it's a responsibility to the public health crisis of gun violence. And to say there's no historical basis, of course, that's what we do here. We create laws, we keep up with the times, we keep up with technology, and we create history as we work. So I don't dispute that there's maybe not a historical basis for this, but it's certainly relevant and worth having that conversation and taking meaningful steps. And I would just say, too, that I disagree that the bill regulates speech. I think there's a clear distinction between speech and instruction manuals and instruction manuals that can cause harm to people. And so I think anything we can do as a legislature to put barriers up so that folks can't misuse these kinds of weapons is an important step to take. Removing a serial number is one more step that someone would have to take before committing a crime if they don't want to get caught. And I think these are good solutions, and I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Okay, very well. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been listening to testifiers and what we've been saying, but I don't think we quite are grasping what we truly want to grasp here. And Representative Pinto, my first question to you would be, and you're all three lawyers up there, do criminals follow the law?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Duran, if you're defining criminal as somebody who's violated a particular law, then they violated that particular law. That's what I'd say.
And I guess under that logic, yeah, there's no point in having any laws?
Well, indeed, right? I yes. There's been a lot of proposals that would
violate
that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really wanted to get that through. Criminals don't care. Uh-huh. Criminals do not care what laws we put in place. Criminals do not care what you do. Criminals do not care about your feelings. Criminals do not care. So actually doing this is only going to actually, what we're doing is we're actually punishing law-abiding citizens. Criminals do not care about what you think putting a serial number or just a label on a gun is going to do for us. They're going to do it no matter what. And these are some of the points that, I wish that we could just come to the table and actually work on some of the issues that, you know, a lot of this is going. And, I mean, let's fight back on the gangs in some of these areas. Let's fight back on some of the actual criminal behavior that are leading to some of these shootings that would actually go. That would be great for us to be able to do. So if we want to truly work on fighting criminal behavior, I think we should all come together and figure out ways that we can fight back some of those criminal behaviors, some gang activity maybe, maybe try to, stop it before it gets too quick. But a lot of these gun activities, a lot of these ghost guns, are we finding this throughout the state of Minnesota? Maybe this is for you, Representative Pinto. Are we finding problems with ghost guns throughout the state of Minnesota, or is it just kind of in Hennepin County or Ramsey County?
I directed the testifier.
Go ahead, Mr. Maloney.
Madam Chair, Representative Duran, you've heard from the Minneapolis police chief who was talking about, what that department has seen. The AG also gave you statewide numbers that were obviously larger than what the chief testified to. So I can't break it down by city or by county sitting here, but there is a problem with ghost guns outside of Minneapolis and outside of the Twin Cities metro area.
Mm-hmm. Representative Duran.
Yep. Thank you for that. But, I mean, is it really focused on some of these areas where there's a lot of criminal behavior where people just don't care about any of these laws? I mean, because they couldn't necessarily have permission to have some of these guns if they're maybe doing it for gang affiliation or they're felons in general. So this is what I'm trying to get to is, we're trying to actually limit the amount of what good law-abiding citizens would actually have been doing for multiple years. And criminals don't care what laws we want to put in place because they haven't cared yet, nor will they care in the future. And you've said multiple times, increasing penalties on things is not going to hinder people from doing things. You've said that. So what are we doing here? We're increasing a penalty for something that has been... we're actually creating a penalty for something that we've been doing for such a long time. Is that going to stop criminal behavior? Because you said increasing penalties for things are not going to stop criminal behavior multiple times. So can you give me a little bit on that?
Sure.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Duran, a reminder, when you said this has been going on for years, this is since last August. So before last August, the possession of a firearm without a serial number was illegal under Minnesota law. The Supreme Court reinterpreted the statute in a manner that that causes this to be necessary to revert to back where we were before, with the additional ability to serialize firearms that we didn't have that ability before. So it's actually an improvement of where that was before. So reminder that that's the situation we're talking about. It's only been a few months, really, this has been going on. And Representative Duran, what we do, and I was looking at some bills that you've introduced, you know, creating a new crime for assaulting a security officer at a hospital, right? Somebody that presumably that's a criminal who's doing that, and yet you believe that that is an important important law to pass, right? What we do is we establish in our laws the expectations that we have for conduct. And we say that in this case, if you take on the responsibility of possessing a firearm, then in that case, that firearm needs to have a serial number. So if that firearm ends up being used in a crime, there's the ability to investigate, the ability to have a background check as it moves between people, and there's that deterrent, the three factors that the Attorney General referenced. Attorney General also may have some things he wants to add.
Yeah, Attorney General, and we do need to move on. So please go ahead and answer that. Go ahead.
Thank you, and I'll be quick, and I do appreciate the question, Representative Duran. Here's the thing. A gun trafficker will go to a retailer and buy perhaps 30, 40 guns at a time, or within a very short period of time, a few weeks. When that happens, it is, and then they will sell them, so they won't have them. And they're gonna say, oh, they were stolen if they're caught. If we can have serial numbers on these guns, which may be ghost guns as well, it will allow us to figure out who the last possessor, who the last owner, where the gun came from, and will help us crack down on that particular trafficking. So the serial numbers become very important if we do not want to create an illegal commerce in guns, which I know as you as a former police officer is something you don't want to see. So that's the real idea. It's not about whether the criminals like it or not. It's about our ability to detect them and find them and then hold them accountable.
Final comment.
Real quick. And I agree with Representative Pinto about my bills. It's because I actually like to punish people who actually break the law and punish people who actually should be held accountable. That's what we should be doing here. And I don't think doing this against law-abiding people is great. And Attorney General Elson, we've talked about this before, and you agreed with me that this is not going to solve all our problems, because if guns are stolen, I mean, we know the circumstances on any of this stuff. Sometimes we can't link even a serial number to the actual person that committed the crime because it's not their own gun. So, you know, serial numbers are not going to fix all the crimes, and the people just don't care either. So I guess I'm done.
Quick response, Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Attorney General.
I'm sorry, but so Jerome Horton. Please think about that name. You could even look it up on your phone. This guy bought a whole bunch of guns from a local retailer, sold them to some criminals, and those guns were found on the crime scene where Markeisha Wiley was killed, walking distance from here. Because they had serial numbers on them, we were able to find Mr. Horton, and Mr. Horton spent several years in prison because of his gun trafficking activity. So you're right. We will not solve all bad conduct that human beings engaged in with just this bill. It will take a number of bills, but this will help. And I can promise you one thing. The family of Markeisha Wiley feels better knowing that the trafficker who put guns on the scene that resulted in their daughter's life is being held accountable.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. This is obviously more of a comment than a question. I think it's so important that we center ourselves in this conversation. Owning a gun is a heavy responsibility. It is an item that can take somebody's life on purpose or even accidentally. And I really think that having serial numbers on it is the absolute bare minimum that we are asking of gun owners, of lawful gun owners. I am so amazed that we are even having this discussion. We regulate dangerous things in this country, in this state. We regulate cars, we regulate drugs and alcohol and nicotine. We regulate all sorts of things that can kill people and put people in harm's way. That's not abnormal. So the fact that we have folks coming up here and testifying saying that this is the most dangerous thing we can do is to regulate firearms is just bananas to me. And to say it in a room where there are gun violence victims sitting here, where like half a year ago, children were shot and killed while at church, and we're saying you can't have a serial number, that's too hard, that's violating your rights, I'm sorry, that's beyond the pale. So that's my comment. Thank you very much for bringing this bill, Representative Pinto.
Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. Just want to hammer down on the fiscal note here. I see in the bill there's felony after felony after felony. Are we assuming that everyone will just abide by the law and there will not be any arrests made in any prison beds for this?
And I'll turn it over, but I assume it's just because it's reinstating what was
I think that's, ahead, I think that's right. Well, yeah, I know. I think that's right, Madam Chair. And that, I think the fiscal note speaks for itself, Representative Steer. I don't know that I can add anything to it. I mean, you have it right in front of you. But I think that the chair is correct about that, since it's reinstating prior law in that way.
Right. Before the Supreme Court struck down, these cases were getting charged and prosecuted. Yeah. But because of that being struck down, now they're not. So that's my assumption under the fiscal note. Yeah. Representative Steer. Okay. Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Attorney General Ellison. You mentioned a number, 631 recovered at crime scenes. Can you briefly explain what recovered at the crime scene means? I have a mental image, by the way you describe it, as these incidents are taking place and they're dropping the ghost guns on the ground, or are they being arrested and the weapons are being recovered from their vehicles or their person?
Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you for your question, Mr. Chairman. My understanding is that if the ghost gun is at the crime scene, whether it's on the ground or in the possession of a criminal or something, then it will be counted in that number.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So out of that number that you mentioned, that there's a crime scene, so there was a crime committed, and having that firearm and committing that crime would still be something that would be investigated and prosecuted. So my question is, out of that 361 weapons that you said were recovered at the scene, how many resulted in prosecutions because of other crimes and the applicable federal crimes?
Attorney General Ellison.
Yeah, Chair Novotny, I assume all of them, but I can't say that I know that because I didn't follow those. I didn't come here with that information, but I'll provide it to you as soon as I can.
Chair Novotny.
In the interest of time, I'll take that and I'll just cut to the point. Attorney General Ellison made the statement that this is absolutely needed, implying that this is a crisis. And I'm going to go back to the thing. Zero fiscal note for something that is either it's a problem, it's not. I'm confused. I'm like that. Attorney General Ellison, Representative Hollins, you talk about things that point out that the current laws are working. From the standpoint of the shooting that you referenced had nothing to do with the bill or the gun. Attorney General Ellison mentioned the truck part shooting, which was solved by the current laws that exist. Now, you mentioned also that gun traffickers are going out and buying 30, 40 guns, and I will tell you, Representative Steer can probably confirm this, but if someone goes and buys more than two guns in a month, that's going to set off an alarm at the ATF, and the agency that controls their permit to purchase is going to get an email saying your constituent or person in your area purchased more than two guns in a month, and yes, and ATF will be knocking on that person's door. I can cite many cases. I can't do it right now, but I can provide you with the cases where ATF has followed up on those gun buyers that do the straw buying. With that, I recommend a no vote.
We need to wrap it up. Sorry.
But that's not accurate.
Quickly, Attorney General Ellison.
So how many guns were picked up and did Jerome Horton buy from the retailer?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but Madam Chair, Rep. Novotny, it's 30 or 40 guns, I believe, in total that Jerome Horton purchased from multiple retailers over several months.
And then another individual picked up a similar number?
Yes.
What was their name? Do you remember that?
Sarah Elwood.
So I'm telling you, I mean, it's a fact. I mean, that's why we had ATF employee on the testifying in favor of the bill. It happens. We're just trying to stop it. And I know you all want to stop gun violence, so maybe we can do it together.
Closing remarks, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, just quickly, if you flip to page 25 of the fiscal note, look, here's the deal. This was the law before August, okay? This, the fiscal note says it's assumed this bill will restore the case filing rate to the levels previous. Like, this was the law. I don't think there was a single GOP proposal, maybe I'm wrong about this, to take away serialization, to take away the requirement that was in place before August. It happened that the court read the statute in a particular way, which is why we are fixing it. We're getting back to the way that it was before, but now we're actually providing a route for someone who possesses an unserialized firearm to get it serialized. That's a helpful thing to somebody who has an unserialized firearm. We're getting the law to back where it was before. I have charged these cases repeatedly when somebody possesses an unserialized gun. That was something we didn't think about because the law just said what it was, and that's what it was, and nobody's complaining about it. It ended up working perfectly fine. We're trying to get back to that, and because of that prior law, we ended up being able to make the progress that the Attorney General is referencing. You're hearing from law enforcement, you're hearing from county attorneys about the need to have this. There is no reason that we cannot have, when you have a product as a gun, we get back to the way the law was before. They have a serial number on the gun. And I will note, I know that we have vehicle registrations. We don't have a Second Amendment. Note, people drive all the time. People own cars. They drive all over the place. No diminution of your ability to drive, right? We're talking about an important step to get back to where we were before. Madam Chair and members, please, please, please vote yes for this bill. Thank you.
Representative Pinto renews the motion to re-refer House File 3407 to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Chair Mueller, aye. Chair Novotny.
No.
No. Chair Novotny, no. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist, aye. Vice Chair Whitty.
No.
Vice Chair Whitty, no. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg, aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran, aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Duran, no. Representative Engen.
No.
Representative Engen, no. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Hollins.
Yes.
Representative Hollins, yes. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson, no. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, yes. Representative Pinto.
Yes.
Representative Pinto, yes. Representative Ream.
Aye.
Representative Ream, yes. Representative Rapinski.
No.
Representative Rapinski, no. Representative Schwartz.
No.
Representative Schwartz, no. Representative Steer.
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Tapke.
Yes.
Representative Tapke, yes. 10 ayes, 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Members, we'll move now to the first bill that was on the agenda, House File 2354. It's a Representative Norris bill, and the Attorney General is still here for that bill. So, Representative Norris, I will move to re-refer House File 2354 to the Committee on Ways and Means. I see that you don't have any amendments, and so when you can, please explain your bill for us.
All right. Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. Like so many Minnesotans, I am furious about fraud, and it's why I introduced this bill last year to beef up the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. It had bipartisan support here in the House and continues to have bipartisan support. We successfully passed it out of the House last year, but unfortunately it got stuck in the Senate, so we're back taking another swing at it this year. Medical assistance fraud steals from hardworking taxpayers across Minnesota. It also steals money that's meant to go to low-income Minnesotans. That's disgraceful, and we're here to crack down on this kind of fraud. This bill does what Minnesotans expect us to do: enhance our ability to investigate fraud and stiffen penalties for those who steal from government programs. Simply put, this bill supports the work of catching people who steal from medical assistance and makes sure that they're held accountable. Thank you, Chair Mueller.
All right, and I see that Attorney General Ellison is back again. Welcome back to the committee, but please introduce yourself again for the record.
For the record, my name is Keith Ellison. I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota, and thank you, Chair Novotny, Representative Norris, Chair Mueller, and members of the committee. Let me be very brief today. We have the benefit of having the man who leads our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. I can tell you that this is a completely non-political group. They get referrals and they prosecute criminals. That is what they do, and they do a pretty good job of it. We have been assessed by the authorities who run the Medicaid control fraud units in every attorney general's office in the country, and been found to have been doing very well, except for they believe that our unit is too small, and they're right, because we have been able to convict over 300 people since in the last 7.5 years, and that is in the top 10 of all states, and yet our numbers are far smaller than states that are prosecuting far less people than we are. We need the help. This bill is to increase the number of people who can help us investigate and organize and prosecute people who steal from the public. And we hope to earn your support. Today I'm going to let Mr. Nick Wonka pull the heavy oar. He is the line prosecutor who does the work every single day and leads it in our organization.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please begin your testimony.
All right. Thank you for the introduction, Attorney General. I'm Nick Wonka, the director of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and I'd like to elaborate on just a couple points the Attorney General made about the specific pieces within your jurisdiction today. Those are the penalty provisions. Right now, the penalty provision for medical assistance fraud is a maximum of 2.5 years in prison. That's regardless of the amount someone defrauds from the program. $10 in fraud, max of 2.5 years in prison. $10 million in fraud, a max of 2.5 years in prison. You can check Minnesota Statute 609-466 yourselves. There is no delineation at all in the amounts stolen. That's not an appropriate way to apportion accountability for the types of long-running intentional fraud schemes we see. It seems patently apparent that someone in a $10,000 fraud scheme should be treated differently from someone in a $1 million fraud scheme. That's already done in other provisions of the criminal code, most notably our theft statutes, where the penalties change as the amount of the victim's loss does. These actions in the MAP Act address that. They have escalating penalties for high-dollar cases. They reflect appropriate accountability for long-running crimes that rob the state of money that should be going to caring for some of the most vulnerable people in Minnesota who need that money to pay for their health care needs. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that. And we did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify. Member discussion, we're looking at sections 3, 4, and 5 of the bill. Representative Ingen, you're moving your microphone. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris, and thank you, Representative Ellison, or AG Ellison, for being here. Why now should we believe that you'll fight against fraudsters and not fight against state agencies on the fraudsters' behalf?
Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative, Minnesota law requires that the Attorney General can only have original jurisdiction in Medicaid fraud cases if there was a criminal act performed by somebody who was not directly accused of Medicaid fraud. We would have to get the county attorney in which the fraud occurred to refer the matter to us. That's the law. You all have the power to change it, but that's the current law as it exists right now. So I guess theoretically, if there was proof that somebody in the program criminally participated in Medicaid fraud, and there was a factual basis, I think we probably could move forward on that one. But at this point, these kind of crimes, unless they are Medicaid fraud, the county attorney in which the fraud occurred has the jurisdiction for those cases.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while that didn't answer my question, it's from my understanding, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island have their Medicaid fraud units located within the BCA. Is that something that could be done, to your knowledge?
Attorney General Ellison.
At this point, Representative, our organization, the Medicaid Control Fraud Unit, is located in the Attorney General's office, and I can tell you that every single attorney general's office has a Medicaid control fraud unit. So I got to tell you that I doubt that is an accurate statement. And if it is, there's more to it than what we're hearing. It's a national program. Every single state AG has a Medicaid control, has what we even have an acronym for it called MFUCU. So, I can tell you every single state law is a little bit different. In New Jersey, for example, the Attorney General is the lead law enforcement professional for everybody and leads the investigative agents. Minnesota does it different. So within the scheme, within Minnesota's law, we're doing it the way it's properly done.
Thank you. And I'll just add, as somebody who prosecuted cases at the Attorney General's office years ago, I did felony levels of appeals, and those were at the request of the county attorneys, similar to the prosecutions that that office does, aside from the Medicaid Fraud Unit, which is its own entity.
That's right.
Anything else, Representative Ingen? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Attorney General Allison, for being here to speak to this today. My question is regarding the appropriation and how it would be spent by your office. So we're talking about roughly $800,000. Has there been any thought put into exactly how that would be spent, who you would bring on, and what the predicted outcome would be in terms of how that money would be deployed?
And I'll let him answer that. That is outside of the scope of this committee. But go ahead, Attorney General.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hudson, I'm going to allow Mr. Wonka to talk about how we're going to allocate that particular human resource, should you all be able to support our bill.
Mr. Wonka.
Yes. So the budget request is for 18 people. That would be 3 prosecutors, 11 investigators, and then there would be 4 support staff. 2 of those would be paralegals. 2 would be legal secretaries.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that answer. So is that, I'm just trying to understand where the proposal comes from. So is there any kind of indication that providing those resources and those number of FTEs is going to have a significant impact upon your Medicaid fraud investigations?
Mr. Wonka.
Yes, there is. So that right now, the logjam that we have is in the number of referrals that we're getting and our ability to quickly and effectively investigate them. We have last federal fiscal year, so from October 1st of 2024 to September 30th of 2025, we had a little over 200 referrals that came in from law enforcement, from DHS, from MCOs. We exceeded 200 referrals in early February of this year, so in a little over 4 months. So what we need are people who are on the ground, investigators who can go out and talk to people, talk to the recipient who says, I didn't get any services from this agency. I don't know how they got my information. They can go out and execute search warrants. They can go out and review healthcare records and compare them to the claims for reimbursement and build those fraud cases. So that's where our right now logjam is. Having these additional resources within our Medicaid fraud unit will help us get more cases out the door quickly and efficiently.
All right, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and really appreciate this bill. As a member of the Fraud Prevention and Government Oversight Committee, I'll say we have never had the conversation about needing to restructure the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, partially because I think it is punching above its weight as we look to other states that we know all 50 states have these. I guess I'm just wondering, as we, and particularly for this committee, the graduated and strengthened penalties, can you talk about how, as a prosecutor, that will help you in these cases and give you more tools to do the work that I think we continually say we care about, which is ensuring that that people get the services they need and that taxpayers aren't ripped off?
Mr. Wonka?
Well, I think that what you see with this is this measures appropriate accountability for these high-level schemes, and I think that not only it helps us send a message to any fraudster that, like, look, we as prosecutors, we as lawmakers, take this seriously, right? If you commit a high-dollar offense, there are serious consequences here for it that don't exist now. And that's really the biggest message that I think comes from a bill like this, is you are facing a significant maximum penalty if you steal millions of dollars from the Medicaid program. And that will be true whether you were prosecuted in federal court or in state court. And that's what we're hoping to do with this. And also just to recognize that, like, look, people who steal a lot of money should be treated differently than people who steal a few thousand dollars. And that's not in the Medicaid assistance fraud statute right now. This will ensure that that is there and that it is something that is a state we say we do take this seriously. So.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I'm on Ways and Means, so I'll go after most of my questions in Ways and Means when we talk about the number on this. Once again, we're reviewing the note, and either we have a huge problem and we have a huge amount of prosecutions that will result from this change in law that we're going to give all this money to, or there won't be, as it's reflected in the fiscal note. But as I said, we'll go after it in that and address the numbers there. Obviously, we all want to fight fraud. We all want to make sure that our tax money is spent in a good place. We've got a lot to go after. I, like many of the members on my side, have concerns over the effectiveness of this office going after that. We can address that later. So I will be able to actually go after the sections that I want to. We'll let it go to a voice voter. Thank you.
Okay. Closing comments, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, and members of the committee. I'll end by highlighting kind of some objective numbers about the effectiveness of this office. So the federal government, their Health and Human Services, OIG, did an audit of our unit from 2020 to 2022 and found that Minnesota won the most convictions for provider fraud when compared with similarly sized states. So I think that shows that objectively this unit is doing good work. The tools we're giving them in this bill will allow them to do even more good work. So thank you.
Thank you. And I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 2354 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Members, we're next going to move.
Division.
Okay. Hold on one second. No. Okay.
Never mind.
Okay. Thanks again. All right. Never a dull moment here. All right. Next up, we have House File 4359, Representative Berg. And I believe that your motion, Representative Berg, is to recommend that House File 4359 be placed on the General Register. I know you're still making your way to the table.
Yes, that is my motion, Madam Chair.
And I do see that you have the A1 amendment. Do you have any comments on the A1 amendment?
I do not. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All right, we'll take up the A2 after we've heard the bill. And so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So this is not a new bill. We've heard this one before. And I just want to start out by saying that I know that how this bill came about, the tragedy in Burnsville, is personal to a number of our committee members who are part of the law enforcement community, and I know it hits you pretty hard when you lose brothers and sisters in law enforcement. So I wanted to acknowledge that for those of you today. What I'd like to do just, I guess, in terms of a bit of an opening statement, is just read a couple of lines from some of the letters that are in your packet. The family of Adam Finseth, our firefighter paramedic, have chosen to communicate with me since the tragedy happened, and did get their permission to highlight some of their words today. So in your packet, you will see a letter from Adam's sister, Amber. And I just want to read what she says about her brother. My brother, Adam Finseth, was murdered while serving his community as a firefighter paramedic for Burnsville. On the morning of February 18th, he was shot and killed while tending to two police officers, Paul and Matt, and attempting to keep seven children from harm. My brother was a veteran and had also survived cancer, but it was gun violence in an American suburban neighborhood that ended his life. Adam's parents wrote, "Our son Adam survived two tours in Iraq while serving the Army for 7 years, and we never suspected that our Adam would be murdered on the streets of Burnsville by a felon that was prohibited from having a firearm, much less a binary trigger firing over 125 rounds of lethal ammunition. These weapons are for military personnel, not for our safe streets of Minnesota. So I think those are the kind of the best opening remarks to be had as we begin to discuss this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we did have three testifiers sign up in opposition, the same three testifiers that were on the other firearm bill. So if you want to make your way to the testifier table. And I assume we'll just go in the same order again. So I'll leave it to you to introduce yourself when you're ready and begin. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mariah Day with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. I won't go over my written testimony in great detail. You have that in front of you. But I do want to point out that NSSF appears today in opposition to HF 4359, which seeks to put into effect the criminalization of certain legal triggers for firearms. We believe treating these triggers akin to machine guns is inaccurate. As we have previously argued, a ban on the possession of these devices constitutes an uncompensated taking from legal firearm businesses and owners by the state and is a violation of Minnesota citizens' Second Amendment rights. In March of 2022, the common trigger type known as a binary trigger was specifically cited by the ATF as a device that would not qualify as a machine gun component, as binary triggers do not allow a firearm to discharge more than one round through a single function of a trigger. However, despite this clear guidance from the agency responsible for enforcing federal firearm law, the state of Minnesota still chose to adopt restrictions on these products as restrictive as the state's prohibition on machine guns. A binary trigger is a relatively expensive firearm component. The market value is in the $400 range. A statewide ban on these devices results in a loss of value to their owners, and the need to purchase and install some other equivalent high-end trigger would cost approximately $800 per firearm. So that would be total value lost, new component cost, and gunsmithing expenses. We still see no evidence that Minnesota would adopt a grandfather clause covering existing binary triggers in circulation, nor a proposed budget to reimburse owners who are mandated to modify their firearms. Again, these triggers are not illegal at the federal level. As such, their criminalization in a single state where they are legal elsewhere destroys the firearm's value, constituting a taking from the owner. We would respectfully urge you to oppose HF 4359. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Anna Leamy with the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. I want to start and be clear from the beginning that the Gun Owners Caucus does not oppose the provisions in House File 4359, which address straw purchasing of firearms. Targeting criminal conduct and unlawful transfers to prohibited persons is a legitimate area for legislative action and one that can garner broad bipartisan support. However, we oppose House File 4359 as drafted, because it combines that issue with the reenactment of the trigger activator ban, which raises serious constitutional concerns and remains the subject of ongoing litigation. This bill combines two fundamentally different policy questions into a single bill. These are not the same issue, and they should not be legislated together. Members who support stronger penalties for criminal conduct should not be required to also support a constitutionally questionable restriction on lawful firearm ownership. The trigger activator ban remains constitutionally suspect. The reenactment of the trigger activator ban is not a technical fix. It is a substantive policy that directly implicates the Second Amendment. As the Supreme Court made clear, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, the government must demonstrate that a restriction is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. There is no historical tradition of banning firearm trigger mechanisms or internal components commonly possessed for lawful purposes. This is not a regulation of misuse. It is a prohibition on a category of firearm functionality. House File 4359, as drafted, unnecessarily combines a broadly supported criminal enforcement measure with a controversial and constitutionally suspect firearm restriction. For these reasons, I respectfully urge you to vote no on House File 4359.
Thank you. Welcome back again. Please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Brian Gosch, National Rifle Association, here to oppose this bill as well. This bill takes a different direction than what our neighbor to the west did. North Dakota in 2019 specifically passed a law saying binary triggers were legal. They have a definition in code that said fire 6 rounds per second. That's their definition of machine gun. That was needed to make clear that these were illegal to manufacture and sell from that state and ship out of that state. You heard testimony that the ATF has declared and stated that this does not make a firearm a machine gun. This should not be illegal. You heard testimony from the proponents that this was a weapon of war. Binary triggers aren't used by infantry. They're not used by our military. It's not a weapon of war. And with the ATF determination, that goes to, I think, a logical conclusion then that binary trigger does not make, the binary trigger itself is not dangerous or unusual, which is the test in District of Columbia versus Heller. Not being dangerous or unusual then should be allowable. Finally, this bill does handle multiple subjects, as was testified to it. One of the things it throws in there is removal of affirmative defenses for family members who are prohibited people, try to force you to sell them a firearm. This takes that away, making it more dangerous for that person in that exact moment. And I would suggest that that's probably not good policy. So with that, I'll stand by for questions, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We will now move to the A2 amendment. Who will be offering the A2 amendment? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A2 amendment would delete Section 1, which is the section that involves binary triggers. And let me be as clear and blunt as I possibly can be. This is an effort to break the fourth wall of political theater. As has been established by the testifiers, if you vote yes on this amendment, we're passing the bill out of here. Because we all agree that straw purchasers should be held accountable. Tying that completely unrelated issue to binary triggers is nothing less than a poison pill, and we all know it. I don't know that I need to belabor that point. It's very obvious what's happening here. And I just want to stress the fact that we live at a point in time where these types of political tricks are extraordinarily apparent to the broad public because there are no more bottlenecks on information. People know what you're doing. So you're either serious about the straw purchasers or you're not. And that's what we're about to find out. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'll comment on that. Let me be very clear that this bill, as drafted, is the same bill that we passed last year with bipartisan support. Three members of the other side of the aisle voted for the bill off the floor, including one member on this committee, voted it out of committee, and it is they are very much tied together for a reason, because both issues were at play in the Burnsville murders. We had a binary trigger that was used as Amber, the sister, just talked about how it increases semi-automatic weapons rate of fire, that there wasn't time to react. And we also know that the straw purchaser was an issue in the Burnsville case as well. So they are very much tied together. I resent the fact that it's called political theater because it's not. It's meant to address an issue that is a very important issue in the state and that we passed with bipartisan support in the past. And the only reason the straw purchaser is not before us, that we need to redo it, is because the Gun Owners Caucus and others sued because they didn't like how it was included in the big omnibus bill. That is the only reason why we are here having to redo either that and or the binary trigger. I don't know, Representative Berg, if you want to add any further comments to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That certainly covered it. I guess the only other thing I would add is that I'm glad the families aren't here to have to hear about political theater when we know exactly how their loved ones were killed. I will also say this is not a wildly, out of nowhere proposal. There are 10 states that already ban binary triggers. You'd probably be interested to know that Florida, Idaho, Iowa, which allows for private ownership but not the sale of it, there are red states that understand that these binary triggers serve no purpose. In fact, we know that a Fargo police officer was killed, and the Republican Attorney General of North Dakota called binary triggers purposeless. And the language that was used around that officer shooting in North Dakota was almost exactly the same verbiage of what happened to our people in Burnsville. I guess I just want you to let that sink in and ask yourself what part of this is theatrical. Thank you.
Any further discussion to the A2 amendment? I'll let you close. Just let's see if there's anybody else. Okay, go ahead, Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to request a roll call, and my only closing comment would be nobody actually believes anything that was being said right now. I mean, come on. We have two completely unrelated topics that are in the same bill. The only purpose of having them in the same bill is so that the bill won't pass. If this amendment is not adopted, the bill's not going to pass out of this committee, and we're not going to do anything about straw purchasers. And then we all know what's going to happen in the theatrical world of politics after that. And I just want folks to highlight and note that this is how the system works. It's theater. It's not real. It's not honest. Let's go to a vote.
Representative Hudson moves the A2 amendment. A roll call has been requested. Chair votes no.
Chair Mueller, no. Chair Novotny?
Yes.
Chair Novotny, aye. Vice Chair Feist?
No.
Vice Chair Feist, no. Vice Chair Whitty?
Yes.
Vice Chair Whitty, aye. Representative Berg?
No.
Representative Berg, no. Representative Bliss?
Yes.
Representative Bliss, yes. Representative Curran?
No.
Representative Curran, no. Representative Duran? Representative Duran, yes. Representative Engen?
Yes.
Representative Engen, yes. Representative Greenman?
No.
Representative Greenman, no. Representative Harder?
Yes.
Representative Harder, yes. Representative Hollins?
No.
Representative Hollins, no. Representative Hudson?
Yes.
Representative Hudson, yes. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, no. Representative Pinto?
No.
Representative Pinto, no. Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Ream, no. Representative Rapinski?
Yes.
Representative Rapinski, yes. Representative Schwartz?
Yes.
Representative Schwartz, yes. Representative Steer?
Yes.
Representative Steer, yes. Representative Tapke?
No.
Representative Tapke, no. 10 ayes, 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. And so now we'll move to a discussion on the bill. Representative Curran?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, for bringing this back. I'm so glad that we passed it in the bipartisan before. I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Further discussion to the bill? No? Closing comments, Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm disappointed. We have tried to do some good work to make our community safer. And I'm thinking about those of you who are either retired law enforcement or have been in law enforcement, and I know that this gutted you, what happened. And despite, for example, the Minnesota Sheriff's Association that says binary trigger should not be available to the general public, despite the support from a variety of groups, not just ones that you typically don't want to listen to on your side of the aisle, but actual members of law enforcement understand that binary triggers are a problem. I heard the definition discussion about whether or not it makes them fully automatic, but when you get one, when you get double the rate of fire because it releases when you pull the trigger and it releases when you release the trigger, we know that it is hard, well, impossible, as it turns out, to mount a defense against that. And so, as Chair Mueller mentioned, when we talked about this just a few short months after the tragedy in my community, of which Representative Whitty was a part of for 27 years with the Burnsville Police Department, we had bipartisan support for this in the same way that we're presenting it today. Both elements were part of the bill that three, at least, of your members voted for. And I don't know if it's because we're further removed from the tragedy. I don't know what the pushback is today on the sudden disagreement of the format here, but I do hope you'll reconsider, because we know that this law including both of those components, make our community safer, and it makes our first responders safer. And I know you want that, so thank you, Madam Chair.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
Aye.
Chair Mueller. Aye. Chair Novotny.
No.
Chair Novotny. No. Vice Chair Feist.
Aye.
Vice Chair Feist. Aye. Vice Chair Whitty.
No.
Vice Chair Whitty. No. Representative Berg.
Aye.
Representative Berg. Aye. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss. No. Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Curran. Aye. Representative Duran.
No.
Representative Duran, no. Representative Ingen.
No.
Representative Ingen, no. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Harder.
No.
Representative Harder, no. Representative Hollins.
Yes.
Representative Hollins, yes. Representative Hudson.
No.
Representative Hudson, no. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Johnson, yes. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Ream.
Aye.
Representative Ream, aye. Representative Rapinski.
No.
Representative Rapinski, no. Representative Schwartz.
No.
Representative Schwartz, no. Representative Steer.
No.
Representative Steer, no. Representative Tapke.
Yes.
Representative Tapke, aye. 10 ayes, 10 nays.
There being 10 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail. Members, the next bill is House File 3356. It's a Representative Hewitt bill. And because you're not a member of the committee, I will recommend that House File 3356 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Civil Law, and Finance Committee. All right. And you do have an author's amendment. It's the DE2. I will move the DE2 amendment. Can you please explain the amendment? Representative Hewitt.
The amendment gets it in the order of how I want the bill to go. This bill is simply a bill that orders the decommissioning of a police vehicle only. We changed it from emergency vehicles. Now it's just a police vehicle. That's pretty much a summary of the DE.
Great. And I do see that you have the A3 amendment to the DE2, so I'll move the A3 amendment. Would you please explain the A3 amendment?
Sure. This is with much negotiation between your crew on our colleague side here and others. Hopefully to get the bill in the place we need it to move it on its way.
All right, thanks. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The A3 amendment to the DE2 is adopted. Next, we'll move to the underlying DE2 amendment as amended. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE2 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. And now with that, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Novotny. This is a bill that we've been working on through the summer. And I've actually had this in my mind for years because of various things I've done in my own career of seeing ambulances that were supposedly decommissioned, but yet they're painted up like a Viking symbol and coming down the road with red lights on them. But really where this hit home is definitely June 14th when I saw the vehicle that was in the speaker's driveway, and it was definitely one that the common public could not have told that was not a police car. This person used that to gain access, to pretend they were a police officer, and then I started the research on this project, and it seems like this is an ongoing thing around the country where people buy these vehicles. Sometimes they outfit them themselves. Sometimes they get them fully outfitted, and they use them to pull over victims or others. Now, we haven't had a lot of it here in Minnesota, but I don't want to go that route. Now, will this fix everything? It will not. People can go on eBay and buy these things and stuff like that, but this is merely a start. The big tackle in this whole conversation is the lights, and everybody I talked to about this said we need to come back, but that's something we could probably put off. This bill here as it stands, I think we're in the right position to go forward. There are some letters of support in your documents. Back to you, Chair.
All right, thank you. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we'll move to member discussion. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Does this include the spotlight on the car as well?
Representative Hewitt.
That was a hard negotiation, and it does. So I know we talked about that numerous times, and
The chair and I, Chair Novotny and I sat down yesterday and we left it in. It would be like a $5 piece of plastic to cover it, but we did leave it in to be removed from the vehicle.
Representative Duran.
And we're sure on the $5 piece of plastic? Because I was kind of told it would be pretty expensive for the department to kind of do something like that. Is that for sure numbers, or because we're adding more and more costs to, you know, maybe smaller departments that won't be able to have the funds that would cut into?
No, but I understand that, I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Hewitt. You're fine.
I appreciate that, and this will stop in Ways. Is that correct?
It's going to Judiciary next.
Yeah, it's going to Judiciary, so I will have more research done on that, sir, and if I hate to pull it off, you know. So anyways, go ahead.
That's fine. Thank you.
All right. Chair Novotny.
I encourage yes.
All right. Closing remarks, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing the bill today.
All right. I'll renew my motion to re-refer House File 3356 as amended to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Pinto back again. And Representative Pinto's bill, House File 4192, and I believe your motion is to re-refer House File 4192 to the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee.
That's correct. That's my motion. This is kind of one of your classic Pinto-Heintzman agriculture, handing up an agriculture bills. So many of those every session, and this is one of them. Madam Chair, House File and members, and Chair Novotny, House File 4192 was brought to me by the Department of Natural Resources. I think in my role as the DFL lead on the Fraud Prevention Committee, this is they're attempting to address some issues relating to registration and licenses and passes and permits, et cetera. And I would like to have my testifier describe the bill.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair's members. Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair, members, this bill is pretty straightforward. It really closes some gaps around fraud when it comes to licenses, permits, and other things issued by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. We're seeing an increase in artificial intelligence that is starting to create fraudulent licenses that our officers are seeing in the field, fraudulent registration stickers for snowmobiles and watercraft. And we're also closing the gap on some areas where we're seeing some dealers, for example, that will write out a 21-day temporary permit for personal watercraft and then have their kids use them for the weekend, and then they bring them back and then they tear up the 21-day temporary permit. Basically, it's a free weekend for their kids to operate personal watercraft. So the bill looks like it's doing a lot, and I can jog through this really quick, Madam Chair, just so people, because it's a lot of copy-paste. So Section 1 is related to off-highway motorcycles. Section 2 would be a copy and paste. It would address the same language for off-road vehicles. Section 3 is basically the same language for snowmobiles. Section 4 is specific to if you're a non-resident or your snowmobile is registered in Wisconsin, you need to get a trail pass in Minnesota. So if you fraudulently created a trail pass to ride in Minnesota, that would take care of that. Section 5 is a copy and paste of the majority of the language or the underlying language for ATVs. Section 6 is for state park permits. So we have had instances where people are trying to create their own state park sticker to put on their windshield, so that would address that. Section 7 is for trail passes, such as cross-country ski horse passes. Section 8 is the copy and paste to address watercraft. And then Section 9, 10, and 11 would be any false statements or altering things for game and fish licenses. And that's the bill, and I'll stand for questions. We'd like to thank Chair Pinto for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Colonel. So many great opportunities for recreation in our state.
There is.
Great. Member questions or comments? Okay. Chair Novotny? No? Any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One note, I think I erroneously said agriculture before, but actually I'd like to make the motion to go to the Environment Committee if I may, as the motion. And I'll maybe just thank the DNR for bringing this to me. Thank the Colonel. I guess I can't resist noting that, you know, this bill is laying out our expectations for conduct for people who want to get licenses, permits, et cetera, per some of the other conversations we've had, right? There may be people who don't follow these laws, and if in that case, we're going to, you know, you're going to identify them, we're going to enforce the laws, and the expectation is that folks, when we let what the law is requiring, then that's what we expect people to do. And so I'm really glad we're going to make this step forward. So I appreciate support on the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And just again, for the record, your motion is to re-refer the bill to the Environment Committee.
Yes. Thank
and
you.
So you renew the motion to re-refer House File 4192 to the Environment Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. And members, I think we are going to take up one other bill now. It's Representative Johnson bill, House File 3695. And this bill does have a fiscal cost, so we're going to be laying this over. So I will move to lay over House File 3695. And I believe you have an A2 amendment, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
All right. Can you explain the A2 amendment?
The A2 amendment just adds a representative from LELS to the task force so that we get all the voices at the table that need to be there.
All right. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. And so now go ahead and tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Moeller, Chair Novotny, committee members. This bill is another one of those bills that was born out of some of the conversations that happened after Speaker Meredith Hortman and her husband Mark were murdered, and John and Yvette Hoffman were shot in their homes. One common theme that kept coming up in those conversations is that every single one of us virtually said that if somebody came to the door looking like that, we would have answered it. And that murderer abused the trust that we place in law enforcement, that we place in firefighters, we place in EMS providers to do their jobs, to show up to people's houses and help. Through these conversations, trying to figure out how we make do something in response to that, and standardized IDs were something that came up a number of times, so that it would be quick for me as a firefighter to recognize a law enforcement officer from a different agency or something like that, or for people that are civilians to ask to see this identification, and it is standard across the board. Nearly everyone we talked to thought that this would be a good idea to look into and pursue, and then some of the other things that came up were how can this be helpful beyond just an identification? We talked about doing something with a QR code or a barcode to add qualifications and certificates and training onto the back. So if we have a major incident like the bridge collapse or a wildfire or a natural disaster, and you have people from multiple agencies, multiple backgrounds showing up on scene, they could scan in, they could see their qualifications, they could quickly put people where they need to be. As we had those conversations, we realized that there's a lot of other things to do to build this, and that's where the idea of the task force came, is just to get all those folks in the same room, talk about what's workable, how this works, what we're going to do with it, and ultimately how we move forward with it.
Thank you. And we did not have anyone from the public sign up to testify on this bill, so we can move now to member discussion. Any discussion to the bill? Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. Is this being laid over?
It is. It's being laid over.
Okay,
there's
thank
a fiscal note.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yep. Any further discussion? Chair? No? Well, I'll just say thank you so much for bringing this bill. I know it's a lot of meetings and a lot of work. I know you really wanted to get the solution this year, but appreciate that you're putting together this task force to really get it right. So any closing remarks?
Thank you to all the folks that were part of those conversations. We had a number of meetings. Thank you to the staff for helping organize and keep all that stuff going. And look forward to having any more conversations we need to have on it. Thank you.
Thanks. So I will renew my motion and lay over House File 3695 as amended. And members, as we are going to come back tonight, please make sure to keep the rest of your packets intact for those bills this evening. And for members of the public, you do need to leave the room during the recess, so you can turn your ticket back into the sergeant staff and receive a new ticket when we reconvene. We'll see who's still with us at 6 o'clock when we come back. And with that, the committee stands in recess. I call this meeting on public safety, finance, and policy back to order. Hope everybody had a nice break. We are going to move to House File 4446. It's Representative Johnson's bill. And the motion is going to be to lay this bill over. Is that your motion, Representative Johnson?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my motion.
All right, and your bill is before us. There are no amendments, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House File 4446 is an important bill that deals with survivor benefits for public safety officers who die in the line of duty from exposure-related cancers. It has been established that firefighters and other public safety officers, because of the work that they undertake, have a proportionally greater number of cancer-related deaths than the general population. Studies from NIOSH, or the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, along with many other medical studies, have consistently shown that certain types of cancer are more prevalent in public safety officers than the public, and that's why we are really pushing this bill today. The other important aspects, there's three things I want to hit on with House File 4446. First, this law recognizes the true risk that public safety officers and their families are taking for this career or this service. Second, it aligns Minnesota with the new federal law that addresses these cancers. And third, having this prerequisite certification from the state is a major factor in the federal determination of those benefits. So with that, I pass it off to my testifier.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Scott Vadnais, President of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. On December 18, 2025, the Federal Honoring Our Heroes Act was enacted. The United States Senator Amy Klobuchar, a Democrat from Minnesota, Kevin Kramer, a Republican from North Dakota, sponsored this bill. This law expands access to federal support for families of first responders who die from fire service-related cancer. The International Association of Firefighters supported this bipartisan legislation, which was triggered by a case that arose right here in Minnesota. Mike Piter was a 15-year firefighter who worked for both the St. Paul Fire Department and Maple Grove Fire Department. Over his career, he went on over 8,000 emergency calls, 3,000 which were fire runs. On Valentine's Day 2020, Mike was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia. Before this diagnosis, Mike was perfectly healthy and had no family history of cancer. AML is a particularly aggressive form of leukemia, and even though Mike had advanced treatment through the University of Minnesota, he died just over 6 months later on August 26, 2020. His death shocked the firefighter community, and more significantly, it was an absolute tragedy for his wife, Julie Piter, Mike's and his two children, Matthew and Megan. Dr. Grace Holton, Mike's treating physician at the University of Minnesota, reviewed the case that had just been completed, which found a very strong link between firefighters' work histories and deaths caused by AML. One study found that firefighters were as much as twice as likely to experience AML as the general population. The study found that the risk of cancer from AML was particularly acute with firefighters of Mike's profile, younger firefighters who engaged in multiple emergency runs. There are other studies that have also shown the prevalence of AML in firefighters. A suspected cause is due to the residual benzene from diesel fuel used in our fire engines. In 2022, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC, classified firefighting as a group 1 carcinogen to humans. This means there's sufficient evidence that firefighting itself causes cancer, just to have the job. On October 27, 2021, Public Safety Commissioner John Herring determined that Mike Piter's death was directly related to his 15-year employment as a firefighter and awarded Captain Piter's family the public safety officer benefit under Minnesota Statute 299A. This was the very first PSOB award, and there has only been the only award of this kind in recognizing cancer-related death in Minnesota. However, Minnesota acknowledged something that all firefighters and public safety officers have known for years. These are very dangerous jobs. And while Minnesota acknowledged this awful problem one time, the federal government did not recognize it at all. With the impetus from this case, St. Paul firefighter, St. Paul IFF Local 21 and Julie Piter brought this matter before Senator Klobuchar. She introduced the Federal Honoring Our Fallen Heroes Act and recognized certain work exposure cancer-related deaths as line of duty deaths. House File 4446, the bill before you, would align Minnesota with the new federal law for presumed workplace cancer deaths to make survivors of public safety officers who die from those cancers eligible for Minnesota public safety officer death in the line of duty benefits. This would be a meaningful and important step to recognize these deaths for what they truly are, a line of duty death and a sacrifice made protecting society. Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll just say thank you for that very compelling testimony. And I, as you were talking to, just wanted to reflect on the fact that we had that tragic fire in White Bear Lake recently as well, and thinking about all of the things that our first responders have to experience. And so just want to acknowledge that and appreciate you.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Tiernavani? Nothing? Okay. Closing remarks, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it relatively brief, but for a long time when we think of firefighter line of duty deaths, we thought about fires and collapses and people running out of air and those real traumatic events or car crashes or all those types of things. And we've done a lot to change that. We've changed the equipment that we have changed the training. There's a reason firefighters don't ride around on the tailboards of trucks anymore, and they're in seats with seat belts and all those types of things. And we've done that to reduce the number of deaths. And along with that, we've acknowledged and honored the sacrifice as a line of duty death when it does occur to make sure that those families are not left behind. And then years later, we started to realize that heart attacks, strokes, suicide, things like that were claiming a lot of our firefighters. So we did things to try and change that, different policy changes, different health and wellness initiatives. But we still are not able to get that to zero, but we have worked in the right direction. But we also acknowledge those deaths and honor those as line of duty deaths and make sure those families are not left behind. As President Vadnais testified, the simple act of being a firefighter is a group one carcinogen. Just the job, just the job itself is labeled as that dangerous as a carcinogen. And we've realized today that cancer is killing a lot of our firefighters throughout our communities. And we've done things to try and reduce that. We've banned flame retardants. We have banned PFAS use and tried to limit that. We funded gear washers to make sure that we can wash those poisons out of our gear. We've invested in exhaust systems to get that diesel exhaust out of our stations. The goal of all of this is to reduce the number of firefighters that die every year. But we also know we will probably not ever get that to zero. And House File 4446, we can honor and acknowledge those sacrifices as what they are, line of duty deaths, and make sure that those families are not left behind. So I appreciate everybody's support, and if folks have questions as we move forward, I'm happy to answer them too. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Johnson renews his motion to lay over House File 4446. Thanks again. Next, we're gonna move to Representative Norris's bill, House File 1597. All right, and I will move to re-refer House File 1597 to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I'll also move the A3 amendment. Representative Norris, welcome back.
Thank you.
And is there anything to explain with the A3 amendment? It looks just like a language change.
Chair Moeller, yeah, the A3 amendment just it's a recommendation from DPS, swaps out one member of the task force for another member.
All right, any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and members of the committee. It's great to be back with you again. I am pleased to present this bipartisan bill alongside my constituent, Alexi Stefani. Alexi came to me describing the horrific hit-and-run incident that she suffered. But she didn't just come with a story. She came with a solution. Yellow alerts are a form of public alert system to help law enforcement track down those who commit hit-and-run incidents that result in serious injury or death. They're similar to amber alerts for abductions. They've been implemented successfully in states like Colorado and California. Considering that less than 10% of hit-and-run drivers are arrested and successfully prosecuted in criminal court, this legislation is desperately needed. We've consulted with a variety of experts at MnDOT and the Department of Public Safety about this idea, and we agreed it makes sense to start with a task force that's established by this bill. In fact, this follows a similar path that Amber Alerts followed when we implemented those in our state. The task force would make recommendations to this committee on aspects like analyzing the systems used in other states, determining the types of hit-and-run accidents that should trigger the use of an alert, and establishing the standard form and method for providing alerts to the public. And the best part is we got the fiscal note back, and there's no net cost to this bill. A hit-and-run crash happens every 43 seconds in the United States, so Minnesota should not wait to implement this important public safety tool. And with that, I am proud to turn it over to my constituent, Alexi Stefani, to share her story.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much. Good evening, members of the Public Safety Committee. My name is Alexi Stefani, and I'm a hit-and-run constituent. The implementation of yellow alerts in Minnesota is very important to me and would greatly benefit our community. Oftentimes, we don't realize how serious something is until it happens to us. On the run from law enforcement, a driver ran a neighborhood stop sign and collided with my vehicle's driver's side at approximately 65 miles per hour. My car then hit a concrete streetlight, a stop sign, went through a yard, and finally collided with a house. Although a demolished car remained next to mine, no driver could be accurately identified for prosecution. After reading my no prosecution letter, I knew that I wanted to dedicate my life to improving my community. I enrolled in law school, and I will graduate this spring. I published in the Star Tribune about the importance of yellow alerts, and I reached out to Representative Norris, who has helped me bring this idea to you today. Because of this accident, I missed a month of school and months of college athletics. The fear I had to overcome just to enter a vehicle to attend my appointments is something that I can't forget. Giving up my senior season of college soccer because of my head injury is something that my younger self would never have imagined. Returning to campus, I struggled to find my classrooms and to remember the names of my professors. All while the driver at fault walked free. There needs to be a change, and a yellow alert system is the first step in the right direction, and it should be implemented in Minnesota. It wasn't the shattered window, the cuts, or the bone bruises that hurt me the most. It was the lack of justice that cut far deeper. My father raised me to understand that life is not about what happens to me, but about how I react to those things. Well, Dad, this is my reaction. Thank you so much for your time and for the responsibility that you carry in protecting our community.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony and for, I'm really sorry that that horrific incident happened and there was no justice in your case, but really appreciate that all that you're doing now to make sure that doesn't happen to the next person. So thank you so much. And you can maybe run for the legislature someday, of course, when Matt's gone. Yeah. And, you know, we always need more lawyers in the legislature, right? So it doesn't look like anybody else signed up to testify, so we can move to member discussion. Oh, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing this forward. My family owns a small business, a bicycle business, and they are avid cyclists, and two of them have been involved in hit-and-run accidents, and it really does impact your life in a way that you cannot anticipate, and you are looking around the corner every second, not just for cars, but also because you're wondering who's the person who did this and got away with it. So I appreciate this. They're in Hawaii, so I wish we could bring it there. But hey, let's start with Minnesota. Thanks.
Thank you. We're talking here because the motion is going to change, actually for the better. We're going to change the motion to go to the general register because this ends up being is cost neutral. It doesn't need an extra stop in Waze. And so that will be what we do when we get ready to vote. Any other discussion to the bill? Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. And testifier. Thank you for being here. This has nothing, the remarks I'm going to say have nothing to do with you and Representative Norris. Look, this is just another fiscal note that is on fiscal notes on fiscal notes. I've tried to get a silver alert for years and years, and the fiscal note blows it away. And I know this is a task force, not actually establishing it yet, but just another thing where everything can be absorbed if it comes from the right representative. I'm going to let your bill go through because I think it will make a difference. I just wish that there was some reciprocity on that. And I'm not reflecting on anyone in this committee, but the silver alert is something that has been showed to work for years in states like Florida, where they have obviously a larger elderly population. But I'll say it just one more time. If it comes from my side of the office, it's got a huge fiscal note. If it comes from the other side, zero. Thank you, Chair.
Closing remarks, Representative Norris. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Chair Mueller, and thanks to the members of the committee for your support for this. And I just want to, again, commend Alexi for the fantastic work she's done on this and hoping that we can continue that fantastic work together.
Okay, so again, we're changing the motion to re-refer House File 1597 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again. Next up is House File 3155, Representative Tabke. And I believe your motion is to recommend that House File 3155 be placed on the General Register.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
And you do have an A1. It looks pretty simple. Anything you'd like to explain about the A1?
No.
All right. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. House File 3155 is a bipartisan work to help with gift card theft. So what happens, this is adding language to the organized theft organized retail theft that we passed a year or two ago. I forget exactly when it was, but what this would do is, well, what is happening is that in stores, gift cards are being taken and then tampered with, so they get the information off those gift cards and then they're put back on the shelf. And so from there, someone else unknowingly goes and purchases and gets that gift card, and the people who tampered with it before then know that it's activated, and so then they take the money off of that gift card because they have the information for it. And so these gift cards, and there's currently no recourse for it because the gift card is only valued at the cost of the value of the plastic. It's not the value of the gift card itself. And so this bill would work together to fix these issues as they come forward. And I have a couple testifiers, Madam Chair.
All right, great. We've got Bruce Neustadt and Josh Percola. If you want to both make your way to the testifiers table, and you are already. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Chair Novotny, my name is Bruce Neustadt with Minnesota Retailers. I work with retailers of all sizes across the state. I just want to thank Representative Tabke for his leadership on House File 3155 and Representative Perryman for her support as well. I want to start off by just being really clear. I think Bruce Tabke did a good job, but what this bill does and what it does not do, what it doesn't do is take care of those consumer scams where somebody tricks somebody into buying a gift card to paying a fake utility bill. This bill does not address that, although that is a serious issue that should be addressed. This bill targets organized, sophisticated criminal activity that's happening in our stores. As Representative Tabke said, criminals are taking unloaded gift cards off racks, tampering to capture the card number and the PIN, and then putting them back on the shelf. Then they use sophisticated technology to track when those cards are activated, and they instantaneously drain the funds, sometimes within minutes. The result is that consumers lose money, retailers absorb costs, and trust in the marketplace erodes. Under current law, as Representative Tabke said, if law enforcement stops someone with hundreds of these compromised cards, the charges are often limited just to the value of the plastic, because the card has not yet been loaded. That doesn't reflect the reality of this crime that happens today on an enterprise criminal network level. But I do want to say retailers are not just standing still and letting this happen. We're trying to do what we can. We're investing in training, technology, innovation, and education, and partnerships with law enforcement. Unfortunately, this crime is bigger than what a single retailer or a group of retailers can do to solve it. Frankly, we need your help. House File 3155 closes the gap by aligning gift card fraud with Minnesota's organized retail crime law. It ensures that law enforcement has the right tools to go after organized networks, not individuals or a bad actor, a single bad actor. This is really a targeted, practical fix that matches the sophistication of the crime. So I want to thank you for your consideration this evening. And Chair Mueller, if you'll indulge us, Josh Percola from the Coon Rapids Police Department would love to tell a little bit of a story as well.
Great. Yes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Detective, and begin.
Thank you. My name is Josh Percola. I'm a police officer with the Coon Rapids Police Department, currently assigned to investigations focusing on organized retail crime. I also serve as the vice president of the Minnesota Organized Retail Crime Association. In April of 2024, we were contacted by a retailer reporting a drastic increase in suspicious gift card activity. Suspects were taking large numbers of unpurchased gift cards, altering them, and returning them to store shelves. In a single day, they would visit 15 or more stores across the metro area. One retailer alone reported a loss exceeding $350,000. What began as a retail theft case turned into a seven-month investigation that uncovered a transnational criminal organization operating here in Minnesota. The suspects removed security features from gift cards, recorded the numbers and PINs, then reassembled the gift cards to look untouched. Those numbers were then shared and sold. Once a customer purchased a loaded gift card, the funds were immediately drained. Through surveillance and coordination with retailers, we identified 13 individuals and two residences used as operational hubs. A total of six law enforcement agencies and over 80 state, local, and federal officers executed search warrants, and we recovered over 16,000 altered or in-progress gift cards, along with evidence of broader fraud, including fraudulent bank account information tied to other cases in other states. Despite the scale of this operation, current law only allows us to charge misdemeanor theft because the cards had not yet been loaded with money. But the real victims are the consumers. I spoke with a victim who gave a gift card to her child's teacher to purchase classroom supplies to find the balance was zero. Another victim gave a $200 gift card to a struggling mother who was unable to buy diapers and formula when the card was declined. The embarrassment each victim felt was something they will never forget. This bill would give law enforcement the tools to address this crime at its true scale and hold offenders accountable before more Minnesotans are harmed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We did not have anybody from the public sign up to testify. Do we have any questions or discussion from members? No? It's a quiet bunch tonight. Chair Novotny? No? All right. Closing remarks, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much to Representative Perryman, who's here helping out with this bill and making sure that we have a lot of great support for it. So I appreciate everyone, including Bruce and the retailers and all the folks that this will help. So thank you.
All right. Representative Tabke renews the motion to recommend that House File 3155 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. The motion prevails. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Representative Greenman, you're up next with House File 4437. And as you're making your way there, I believe your motion is to re-refer House File 4437 to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee.
That's right, Madam Chair.
Okay, and you do have the DE2 amendment. Did you want to explain the amendment or adopt it first? What's your preference?
I'm happy to just briefly explain. This was a result of working with nonpartisan staff to make sure that the language worked and put it in the shape that I wanted.
Okay, great. Any questions to the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The DE2 amendment is adopted. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4437 bans the hosting, the operating, and the advertising of prediction market gambling in Minnesota. The regulation of gambling has long been considered the provenance of the state, of tribes, and of local governments, and this bill preserves that authority. So what are prediction markets? Prediction markets are platforms not regulated by the state that allow people to bet on the outcome of future events. The markets are like the ones operated by Kelshi, by Polymart, by Crypto.com that set up a series of binary contracts. And people can anonymously bet on them, and they get paid out based on the outcome of the event. For example, this morning I checked on Polymarket. You can bet on will China invade Taiwan by the end of 2026. You can bet on any number of things that Congress has the authority to regulate, and you can bet on the outcome of any NCAA tournament game and thousands of more things, including the weather, what people will say on late-night TV, et cetera. The platforms make money by charging bettors a fee for bringing together users of the opposite side of a bet, and many platforms also operate clearinghouses to settle bets and participate in the betting with their so-called trading arms. What this has amounted to is an explosion of gambling in the last year without the guardrails and the safeguards that states across the country have been putting around gambling for years. In Minnesota, similar to states around the country, it's been tightly regulated. State and tribal regulators have worked for decades to make sure that there are transparent and effective systems of licensing and legalized gambling. And since I've been in the legislature, there's been a robust conversation about the merits of whether we should expand sports betting in Minnesota, and if we did, how we would regulate it to ensure that customers, that it protects consumer protections, responsible gaming measures, and also includes efforts to deal with problem gambling. And while there are members that are on both sides of this issue about whether we should expand sports betting that are working on this bill and that are in our body, there seems to be broad agreement that whether Minnesota does it and how we do it and how we regulate it, that probably should be our decision to make. These prediction markets circumvent our authority and our gambling laws, and they functionally create an unregulated sports book and a way to bet on almost anything. And they're doing this without the protections like requiring you to be 21 to gamble, without anti-money laundering protections, and without the issues of and the ways to address problem gambling. In addition to the circumventing of those laws, it also opens up to a whole set of things of people betting on anything from elections to wars to disasters. They allow, they create a number of concerns, including ethics concerns, but also they're vulnerable to cheating and manipulation by anonymous insiders. We've recently seen large suspicious bets on world events that have raised concerns, even for those markets, about people with non-public information betting and manipulating the markets. There's also worry that as these markets grow, they could actually start to influence world events, that people would place money, and then if they're in the position to actually influence the outcome, may influence the outcome one way or the other. They create the kind of shadowy financial self-dealing that threatens to corrupt a lot of things we care about, sports, policymaking, politics, and more. And Minnesota isn't alone in trying to deal with this. This is red states and blue states are all trying to bring some mechanisms of enforcement and protect their state's ability to regulate gambling. There's states pursuing policy, there are states pursuing enforcement actions, there's lawsuits, and there's legislation. So what does this bill do? This bill defines a prediction market as a system that allows consumers to place a wage on a future outcome of a specified event that is not determined or affected by the performance of the parties of the contract. And then it lists a set of things like sports and games of dice, war, natural disasters, emergencies, elections, et cetera. You can see it in the bill. And then it makes it a felony to create, to host, to operate the prediction market or to advertise or market that kind of market without that are outside the legal parameters. It includes safeguards in the bill that first require cease and desist notice. So if you are doing this kind of behavior, you'll get a cease and desist notice before it becomes a felony. And it also includes exceptions that preserve the current framework of what the legislature in the past has decided is legal and acceptable within that framework. So that, Madam Chair, is the bill.
Thank you. And I just confirmed, I think there's a fiscal note that's being prepared, and it is making, this bill is making a stop in commerce.
That's the motion. That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And you do have two testifiers, and I believe actually one of them had to leave with an emergency. So we have Leah Patton here. Welcome to the committee.
Please introduce yourself and begin.
Wonderful. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Leah Patton. I'm Executive Director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and I'm here to testify in favor of House File 4437. So the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition is a statewide advocacy group formed through the partnership of our three sponsoring faith organizations, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas, and the Minnesota Council of Churches. So as people of faith, we advocate alongside our neighbors of different religious traditions and backgrounds to address poverty, uphold the dignity of overlooked communities, and mitigate societal harm. So online gambling is not legal in Minnesota. However, prediction markets offer a loophole for unregulated online gambling and sports betting in Minnesota. Trading on these markets can take place on an incredible range of outcomes, which Representative Greenman touched on, from whether a ceasefire between Iran and the United States will be reached by March 31st, and to whether the price of a can of Arizona iced tea will increase this year. The ability to bet on basically any outcome, combined with the online nature of these markets, provides nearly unlimited opportunities to wager and lose significant amounts of money. And this presents a significant danger to those at risk of developing compulsive gambling behaviors, particularly young people. Recent studies show that approximately 6% of college students have a serious gambling problem. Prediction market companies understand how susceptible young people, specifically young men, are to falling prey to this thinly disguised form of online gambling. Companies specifically target platforms and spaces frequented by teenagers and young adults, like online live streaming platforms and social media, for advertising. There are examples of prediction market companies contracting underage influencers to advertise their markets to young audiences. Numerous lawsuits and regulatory actions have identified the predatory practices of these markets, and we know who they're preying upon. The most well-known prediction market, Kalshi, recently decided that they plan to block athletes, indicated they plan to block athletes, coaches, and officials from trading on their sports. This move is essentially a confession that prediction markets themselves are not confused regarding the services they provide, online gambling and sports betting. Minnesotans depend on elected officials to determine what regulations are needed on gambling in Minnesota, not the CEOs of multi-billion dollar trading companies with essentially no accountability for the steep social costs their platforms impose on our communities. We urge you to vote in favor of House File 4437. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for your testimony. We didn't have any other members of the public sign up to testify, so we can move to member discussion. Representative Witte.
Representative.
Can you use your microphone?
Representative Greenman, thank you for bringing this bill forward. One question, what does it do with our March Madness brackets? it's gone around the House before, so I'm just curious.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And unfortunately, it cannot save your bracket. But it does exempt out that private that is already currently in law. It preserves that protection for individual and personal brackets. It can't save your top pick, but it can save our ability to do it together.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? I can't tell if Representative Hudson, that was like a, oh, go ahead.
Sorry, Madam Chair. I myself was unclear as to whether or not I actually wanted to say something, but.
We've reached that point of the evening.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. It's late and it's deadline week, so we're all feeling a little spicy. So I'll just cut to the chase. So if we were to pass this, obviously, the tribal nations can do whatever they want under their sovereignty. So are we actually preventing this activity from taking place in Minnesota, or are we limiting it just to the tribal nations?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would not change anything about the way that we have over decades built up and regulated gambling, both as it relates to the tribal compacts and as it you know, all the other things that we allow on track pari-mutuel betting. And as somebody who is not an expert on gambling, I am actually a opponent of sports betting, but there are people working on both sides. I don't exactly know all the ins and outs, but what I do know is this is about protecting the status quo. So that, and I think that that's a lot, how a lot of states see it, that we have, there's been a lot of policy decisions made both in our relationships with our sovereign tribal partners and also our sovereign tribal nations, and also, you know, age limits. Like we all, I think that there's pretty much uniform agreement that you shouldn't be able to do this unless you're 21, but on these markets, you're 18. Or some of the safeguards in terms of anonymous betting that we're seeing on these markets that's not sort of a current function of our gambling code.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I would ask nonpartisan if they would be willing to comment on their interpretation of whether or not the passage of this bill would have any binding impact on our tribal nations here in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson, or Mr. Johnson.
Representative Johnson. Okay. Representative Mueller, members. Gambling is actually highly regulated, and it's regulated under the federal law. It's the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, IGRA. Under IGRA, if something is legal to be done within the state for all people, then it must be legal to be done on the tribal land as well. However, outside of that, there are different types of gaming, type 1, 2, and 3. This type of gaming, like sports betting, would be a type 1 level of gaming, presumably. And type 1 is highly regulated and is subject to both state regulation and federal approval. So while this is untested, as far as I know, and there may be other arguments, there's a strong argument that it must follow under the regulatory process that is both approval through the compacting with the state as well as federal approval of that compact. So there would at least be an ability to challenge a tribal's ability to offer a prediction market.
Mr. Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure, with all due respect to Mr. Johnson, I'm not sure I understand the point any better. But suffice it to say, I do think it's worth considering whether or not the intent of this bill would actually be manifest if it was passed. So thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. I just want to say thank you to Representative Greenman for bringing this bill. Like, this is a, I think we don't yet understand exactly how bad this prediction market piece is in our communities. It's there. I've heard from parents in Shakopee that have middle school kids who've lost thousands of dollars, and they have a hard time telling their parents what's going on and where things are at. And so this is completely unregulated, tested waters that we absolutely need to have regulation and understanding as to how it works, so that we can both so that we can protect people and our citizens and from this and the marketing that comes along with it. As anybody is watching March Madness, sees lots and lots of ads for these kinds of things, and it feels perfectly normal and like what everybody does, but it is a really dangerous thing to be going down without having any guardrails on it. So thank you for bringing this.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I guess I am echoing what Representative Tapke said. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing this forward. I think one of the things that I didn't hear folks touch on as much was the ethical concerns about making predictions about whether or not we're going to war or another mass shooting happens and things like that. I mean, as a person who is not particularly religious, I think there's some real ethical concerns about creating a system that allows people to make bets on whether or not terrible things happen to other people. And I think it's something that, you know, as a parent, I definitely want to steer my kids away from, but because it's so all-consuming and prevalent, it's very difficult to. So I appreciate this. It absolutely needs to be regulated. You know, it needs to be regulated, period. Full stop.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Witte, the difference would be betting on the office March Madness bracket and someone betting on a fan attacking someone at the March Madness. I can't affect the brackets, but it would be able to affect somebody, you know, if I had enough money on it. Not that I would, but, you know, someone could make that bet and make that thing. So this is why I'm a yes on this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Right. Before you close, too, I just want to thank Mr. Johnson, too, for your House research summary, a very good summary about prediction markets. So thank you for that. Closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to thank Mr. Johnson, not Representative Johnson, for just this. This is, I think, a new and growing area that a lot of states are working on. And we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that the language is right, but it's going to commerce. And so for folks on both sides, if you are interested in this, I'd love to continue working with you on it. In Congress right now, there was actually a question of whether one of these prediction markets was based on something that they had control over and people were betting in it. So could you imagine if there was a vote on whether we would pass this bill or not on Polymarket, and you wouldn't know who was voting on either side? And so I think, like, that's the kind of behavior we're trying to prevent. It's not good for the work we do in our public trust. It's also just not good to have that kind of unregulated speculation and gambling. So with that, Madam Chair, I really appreciate this conversation and the questions. I don't think they were too spicy. I'd ask for a green vote or your vote.
All right, Representative Greenman renews the motion to re-refer House File 4437 as amended to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. All right, Vice Chair Feist is going to take the gavel. Like ketchup.
Great. So the next bill on the agenda is House File 3871. This is Chair Mueller's bill. We are going to lay this bill over. Chair Mueller, your bill is before us. You do have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like to present it in?
I would, Madam Chair. And if it's okay, Representative Curran, this is actually a bill that she presented today in the Judiciary Committee. It's also an agency bill. And if it's all right, she can walk through what the A2 amendment does.
Great. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Chair. So this is essentially amending in, again, House File 3870 that we heard in Judiciary today. The bulk of that bill has to do with information through the Office of Justice programs and just ensuring that the data there has adequate protections, and then also updates some of the terminology to use current terminology that we use in place of battered women. That's old language. We now use domestic abuse victims. So that's another substantial update, and the bulk of the bill is updating terminology.
Great. Thank you so much, Representative Curran. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Chair Mueller, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 3871 is a BCA policy bill designed to address some of the critical gaps in Minnesota law that inhibit law enforcement's ability to prevent child sexual abuse and exploitation of children. This bill clarifies the jurisdiction for CSAM prosecutions to prevent delays in prosecution of these offenses. It also clarifies that when law enforcement is executing a search warrant in CSAM investigations, they have the authority to conduct an on-scene preview of any digital media they find, similar to being able to open like a locked cabinet in a search warrant. And then finally, this bill contains several provisions designed to address the proliferation of childlike sex dolls. We've had some discussions about that in the past, and there is a helpful one-pager in your packets, and I'll turn it over to Superintendent Evans to describe it in more detail.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair. Superintendent Evans, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Chair Moeller outlined, this bill is before you for consideration related to some of our work that we do at the BCA. We have a team in our predatory crime section that addresses the exploitation of children online, child sexual abuse material, and then we also command the ICAC, or the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, which combats child abuse, child sexual abuse across Minnesota, child sexual abuse material in particular, with approximately 100 affiliates statewide. Some of what we're doing with this here today is addressing some of the gaps that we've identified. As Chair Moeller noted, we have encountered some situations where prosecutors have faced some challenges when it comes to venue, and so this is providing a clarification. And what we mean by that is it makes it clear that where the child sexual abuse material is recovered, where it may have originated, where the individual might reside, similar to some other provisions for venue, that it's clear that the prosecutor can charge really in the jurisdiction where the crime is being investigated. And so there's been some situations where we haven't been able to do that, so it's providing that clarification. The second piece is the on-scene previews, just to provide clarification what that means in this particular process. Typically in the past, we would send a team of digital evidence investigators out with our traditional investigators that are doing investigations and executing search warrants, and they would examine the items as we're recovering them at the scene. As you can imagine, at this point in time, we recover dozens of materials in terms of actual digital mediums that we're looking at. That team would be able to actually examine those items on scene, be able to identify them and triage them, so we're examining the right number of items when it comes into our evidence laboratory at the BCA. This is done only with the search warrant. This provision is not providing any further rights or ability for us to do that on scene. It would be done with the search warrant, but providing clarification to the judges that one search warrant would be able to be used for both of those, and then a second search warrant to do further examinations once they are back. As Chair Moeller noted, this has been before you before on childlike sex dolls. We are continuing to seize these as part of our investigative activities. They're just like what they sound, as we're seeing them primarily in these CSAM investigations. They're anatomically correct dolls for individuals as they engage in sexual fantasies of assaulting children. As part of that, we have tried to make some adjustments this year, looking at the penalties, trying to see if that would make this more palatable for members to see as this moves through. And then the last one that wasn't referenced, but it was in kind of at the end, is a duress defense for individuals that are victims of human trafficking. This mirrors federal legislation that was recently passed for the federal component of this, and it was a bipartisanly supported bill in Congress as it moved through there. What this would allow for is victims of sex trafficking in particular, that they would have the defense available to them of duress. I'll give you an example that helps illustrate this. We recently were, in the last couple of years, were investigating human trafficking where individuals of sex trafficking would be sex trafficked, you know, in the evenings by their trafficker. During the day, they were required to go out by their trafficker and commit things like identity theft, steal credit cards, do different crimes related to that. If they did not do that, they would be subject to abuse by that trafficker. And so this provides them that defense. And what we have found is it's more difficult for people to escape being trafficked when they are convicted of various crimes related to that, so that duress defense would be available to them. And as noted, it mirrors really federal law that has been recently passed nationally. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Superintendent. Was Director Boebein going to also testify? Or?
I think she can be available for questions if Great. You have those about the amendment.
Great. Thank you so much. We did not have any members of the public sign up to testify, so we will move on to member discussion. And it looks like Representative Hollins.
No.
Oh, sorry, Representative Pinto, that was old.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Moeller, for this bill, and thank you, Superintendent. There's a lot of really good material in here. I think will make a big difference for the fight against child sexual abuse material and those involved in these just horrible, horrible crimes. I wanted to ask you about Article 3, the duress section. I had done For several years, I was directing training and protocol development for Safe Harbor, the Safe Harbor system in Minnesota, so doing a lot of training related to sex trafficking for law enforcement. And so I'm really intrigued by this. I agree, Superintendent, what you're saying, that so often people who are experiencing sex trafficking end up being involved in other crimes as a result of that experience. One thing that concerns me about this is just the use of the term duress, which I think generally in the law really does mean that somebody's like, at that moment, is having a gun to their head and committing the crime as a result of like being physically forced in that moment. This goes a lot broader than that. And I guess maybe it's sort of coercion, but even that doesn't seem like it quite goes far enough, being quite the right term. If you can just talk about the decision to put it into this section and kind of how you're viewing that.
Yeah, Superintendent?
Madam Chair and Representative Pinto, really the goal in this, because we found so much support nationally, is to mirror the federal legislation. We'd certainly be open to, you know, further discussions on that. The premise behind it is just what you noted, that individuals that are placed in a position because they're being trafficked, forced into these other crimes, that it allows us to be able to rescue them more readily by not having some of these other crimes hanging over their head, and that they may have been forced into these particular crimes. Certainly would be open to further discussions on that. If there's a different way to do this, we are simply mirroring the federal approach.
Okay, thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think I will want to follow up with you, and just we'll have some further conversations about it. But it's certainly intriguing, and I know these are awful situations for the people involved. And the last thing we want to do is put them in an even worse position than already they've been exploited. So thank you for it, and thank you again, Chair Mohler.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mohler, for bringing this bill. I know there's a lot of stuff that we disagree with throughout the course of different committees, but this is not one of them, and you've been a champion on this issue. I want to say thank you to Superintendent Evans. One question I do have for you guys. I've seen this stuff starting to pop up on different mediums of online interaction that kids are starting to deal with, whether it's Roblox, Minecraft. You're starting to see this on platforms that otherwise you wouldn't believe that you could ever see it on, children as young as 5 years old. Can you talk to me a little bit about what you guys have seen and how that's impacted your guys' day-to-day operations in these things, and what we can do to try to get ahead of the curve proactively?
Superintendent?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Engen, you know, I'll just illustrate that I think illustrated well is in about 2016, we had 1,600 tips into the ICAC task force of child exploitation or suspected child sexual abuse material. We surpassed 21,000 last year, and we're 30% above last year's numbers for what we're seeing come in for tips. And so that is a concern of ours. As more specifically to your question, we have seen platforms, not to call them out specifically, but as you just noted, Roblox and others. I will note Roblox in particular has implemented a stronger law enforcement team that's working, and I have seen a real concerted and what I would call an earnest effort out of that platform in particular to try to combat that on their platforms. Unfortunately, we have seen so many challenges when it comes to this part, exploitation of kids online and these platforms, that we collectively need to work together. This is a broader discussion, but I would note that you might have seen some of the national 230 protections that are in place for social media companies nationally is something that probably should be examined by Congress, and I think that's our position in law enforcement, that examining some of those protections would really force social media companies into a position where they have to do more to protect that on their platform, not just identify it, but prevent it from occurring.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was just nodding vigorously.
Everybody's nodding.
Representative Egan.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I know we agree with each other on this one. Section 230 is basically a liability shield that a lot of these platforms are hiding behind when it comes to a lot of this disgusting, absolutely despicable behavior. So thank you so much for the information. Thank you, Chair Mohler, for what you're doing on this, and I look forward to supporting it.
Any other member discussion? Chair Mohler, any closing? Oh, wait, we do. I'm so sorry. I always forget to do that. Chair Navani.
That's fine. Thank you for bringing this bill, as we said. Superintendent Evans, I know this is something that both sides have wanted to get done for a long time, and I'm glad, it's a sad thing that we have to have these bills. Every provision of this bill is written on a tragedy. Hopefully we can get this through the finish line, and thanks for bringing the bill. I recommend a yes vote.
Thank you. And This time, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 3871 as amended. Next, we have House File 3990. It is Chair Novotny's bill. This is the bill we're going to use for the public safety policy package. A list of bills is included in the DE1 author's amendment that has been posted on the committee's webpage. It is included in your materials. The DE1 amendment was posted on Friday for the public. So we'll not be taking any formal action on the bill today, but we'll have nonpartisan staff walk through the DE1 amendment and take testimony, and it's our intention to act on the bill at tomorrow's committee hearing on March 25th. Chair Novotny, do you have any comments before we turn it over to nonpartisan?
Yes, Chair Mueller, I just have a brief question about the original 3990 bill. I know we have testifiers here from MMB. If we have any questions on that particular provision?
Go ahead.
Well, we're bringing this back. There were some questions about the bill and judiciary, but I believe those have been addressed, satisfactorily addressed.
We're still working on that, I guess.
Okay. With that.
All right. Well, we'll turn it over to nonpartisan staff to walk through the DE1 amendment, and it looks like Mr. Diebel's going to start.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The DE1 amendment brings all the bills listed together. It's not into articles, so it doesn't lend itself to an easy summary that to be shared by Ben and I, but I'm going to go through a sequence of bills, and I'll explain to you who the author is, as well as the sections that they are in the bill, because they're not in sequence, because they amend different sections and would get jumbled when we put them together like this. The first bill is Representative Witte's House File 3826, which is a BCA bill related to the fraud investigations and addresses administrative subpoenas, definition of identity, and extends the statute of limitations. You'll find those provisions in sections 1, 25, 31, and 39 of the DE amendment. Representative Johnson's House File 3771 is section 2 of the DE amendment, and this language amends the reporting date for the disaster assistance contingency account. Representative Curran has a bill 3769. This is the DOC policy bill related to substance use and TB screening. Those sections are 3 through 5 and 13 through 18 of the DE amendment. Hansen has House File 3453 included in the bill, and this increases the minimum age to possess and sell, for persons to sell to kratom from 18 to 21. And that's Section 6 of the DE amendment. And then Section 7 through 13 and Sections 40 through 42 are another DOC bill related to the licensing of juvenile and adult facilities. That's House File 3768. And then finally, of the sections that I'm addressing, Representative Harder's House File 3496. This requires the Department of Corrections to consider the person's ability to pay restitution before granting them early release eligibility for certain forms of early release. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Johnson. Sure.
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members. The next bill that is within the DE is House File 3827. That's Representative Duran's bill. This was also a BCA bill specifying that data that the BCA is required to collect must be transmitted in the form that the superintendent prescribes. It also clarifies that certain payments to local law enforcement is treated as a reimbursement, not as a grant, and it requires that notification of orders for protection are provided to law enforcement. Those are in Sections 20 through 22, 32, and 42. Representative Novotny's 3990, which is the vehicle for this, is contained in sections 23 and 24. Those are the provisions that allow public employers to determine whether an applicant for an employment who was convicted of a crime has been rehabilitated and whether the person is fit for a particular position. And then it allows the employers to deny employment to certain applicants who were previously convicted of a crime. Representative Rapinski's 3825 is an Office of Justice Programs bill that's related to victim notifications. Those apply in the prosecutor-initiated sentence adjustments, in plea hearings, and also when charges are eligible for automatic expungement. It also protects the identity of minors who are a victim in a case involving the use of minors in sexual performances. Those are in sections 26, 30, and 33 through 37. Representative Schwartz's House File 2169 is Section 27. That bill amends the crime of second-degree murder to include situations where an order for protection existed to prevent the offender from harming the victim, and that order was issued in another jurisdiction. House File 2358 is Representative Van Binsbergen's increase in the penalties for the crime of coercion when the offender threatens to violate the law prohibiting the non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images and the victim sustains death or great bodily harm. That's Section 29. The final bill we're going to be covering here is Representative Mueller's House File 3782. This is the provision that requires law enforcement agencies to provide information when an officer deploys chemical irritants, and that's in Section 38. Madam Chair, that finishes our walkthrough.
All right, and we did not have anybody sign up to testify. Do we have any, and I'll just note too, there'll be a number of amendments that are coming tomorrow as well. Like we've been talking about them as far as I know, no surprise amendments. But do members have any questions at this point? I thought you were raising your hand, John. I almost called on you. Chair Novotny, any final comments?
It's a good bill. I hope we pass this out tomorrow.
All right, and with that, members, that today's meeting is adjourned.